to the Floor from Chevelle. It's our number one song for the second straight week. You can check out their new album, Hats Off to the Bull, which comes out on Tuesday. We recommend it highly. That's it for us. Get caught up on the entire chart at thesideshowcountdown.com. I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
And we'll see you next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
To WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Hi, Jolene.
Hello, Peter.
Are you ready to do a show?
I'm ready to do a show.
I can tell you really are. There's so much going on, and there continues to be so much going on.
It's never ending.
It's never, never ending.
Never ending madness.
Yeah, yeah. You've got a lot of personal things happening. I mean, not in your...
No.
I'm not going to give away your personal life. Don't worry.
All good things, actually.
You could not run for president. You know that.
Oh, gosh. I wouldn't run for anything. I mean, I kind of head up my block club, and that's about it. All know me.
I don't think I could either. This piece of work, performance artist, formerly known as Herman Cain.
Oh, yeah.
He quit.
Another one bites the dust.
Another one.
You know, we should have had the song up. You know what, Peter? I'm going to kind of miss old Hermie. He was great entertainment.
I have that. How do I get that up? 2QNPW-DST.
Move on.
Yeah, I can't do that.
That's how you do that.
I got this note here. I don't even know how to work it. You know what I don't understand about... hey, by the way, we're going to talk about 100 different things. So you can make it 101 or 102 or 3 by calling 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
If you'd like to email us, it's real easy. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. And great Facebook stuff, and including,
yeah. I'm
go on, brag.
I've got a new article that I'm writing for Inside Macomb magazine, and CK, who's worked with the greater media stations throughout the years, with a lot of different promotions, is one of the higher ups over there, and she asked me to do an article. It's not political, but everything is political,
sure.
Really. But it's about, I'm in culinary school. I really don't talk about it much here on the air, but I'm in culinary school.
Yeah.
In addition to doing all this radio madness. And, so it's going to combine kind of the rock and roll with, the food, you know?
Yeah, and if you go to our Facebook page, which is, facebook.com/nightcall, you can read it.
Yeah,
right?
It's just kind of the intro piece introducing me, and then my column will start officially next month.
Yeah, and
you can see me playing my guitar pan. That's what the picture is.
Yeah, it's a cute one. And we're going to cook together?
Of course we are.
Hey, good looking.
You're going to be...
What you got cooking?
You're going to be part of my, you know, I'm going to interview you.
Yeah. How about cooking something up?
I know that song. Yeah, yeah. Did you want me to sing with you?
No. Well, yeah, my wife has said never, ever sing on the radio.
Well, you're a rebel because you once in a while do things
I do.
Brought a tune
it's
like
terrible.
That.
All right, Herman Cain, the performance artist formerly known as Herman Cain. Unapologetic and defiant, he suspended his presidential campaign on Saturday, pledging he would not go away. Please go away.
I love him. Come on. He's great fun.
He is.
What about the wording, though?
What's
suspended.
That?
It sounds as, you know, when you get suspended, you just have to take a little time out, but you get to go back. He used suspended. What a slime ball.
Well,
down to the very last word.
He's down to 8% of support in Iowa. And Ron Paul is now number 2.
Wow.
In back of Newt Gingrich and ahead of the Mitt.
Yeah,
but,
just all over the place.
At an Atlanta rally on Saturday, Herman Cain said he would issue an endorsement soon. He said the accusations of sexual harassment and of a 13-year affair were untrue. He said, I'm at peace with my God. Now, get this.
There
I'm at peace with my wife, and she is at peace with me. And she, there was Gloria,
right
just
there.
Smiling.
Oh,
and then, you know, and then they closed the door, and she probably said, you
want to
I mean...
To the couch with you!
Yeah, What does that mean?
Remember when Bill Slick Willie Clinton he had to sleep on the couch?
Oh, yeah. So Herman had this 13-year affair with this woman who his wife did not even know that he was friends with, and he was giving her money for 13 years.
Oh, boy.
And you know, the worst part of it all, well, there's a couple issues, partly about male arrogance, but the real, I think, important issue is the way that every woman who came forth with an accusation was demeaned and disparaged, and particularly by these conservatives.
The right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they literally did not believe any single one of them. What's that called? Cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's a condition. You know, I mean, it's not a
denial.
Yeah, you cannot go through life and with that kind of attitude and make sense of anything. But here's what I don't understand. Whoever ran Herman Cain's campaign, didn't they say to him, look, Herman, I don't know anything about your personal life, but if you got anything in it, tell me now, because they're going to find out. It's going to come out. Anything? No. Nothing. Just about four women saying he sexually harassed and one he was banging for 13 years.
I know. Well, yeah. She said that he was a gentleman. He was very nice.
Oh, yeah. And she said it was not a love affair. It was a sexual affair. I mean, she put it right out there.
She was right out there with it. I loved it. Yeah.
And so why you and Herman Cain's and these conservatives' idea was that he was victimized by, well, they had any number of people. First was Mitt Romney, and then they said it was the Democrats. And why in the world would the Democrats want to do that? They would love nothing better than to have Herman Cain be
running.
Why don't you have Herman Cain and what's that woman's name?
Oh,
from Alaska.
Oh, Palin?
Sarah Palin, yeah.
Yeah.
Remember when everybody was
hey,
talking about her?
She might come back. You never know.
Oh, no.
The Newster might have her have her back.
Oh, as the vice presidential candidate. Well, that's a good idea. That worked well last time.
Yeah, I know. Let's do it again. Let's do it all over again.
What else do I have in back here? Oh, yeah. The Newster. This guy, I mean, where do they find these people?
I some foreign land up in space.
I mean, it really makes John McCain look...
kind of normal.
Yeah, he would have like 2% popularity with all of them now. But here's what our favorite columnist for the New York Times, Maureen Dowd, says about Newt Gingrich. He didn't get whiplash being a serial adulterer while impeaching another serial adulterer, which was Bill Clinton, a lobbyist for Freddie Mac while attacking Freddie Mac, a self-professed fiscal conservative while with a whopping Tiffany's credit line, and an anti-communist army brat who supported the Vietnam War but dodged it. Like all those guys.
Fabulous.
Yeah, they were all
guys.
A bunch of chicken hawks.
You know, at least there's a sense of consistency
there is.
Going on here. Yeah.
Newt Gingrich said in a 1985 Wall Street Journal piece about war wimps, or what we call chicken hawks, you know, the ones that supported the war.
But would never go.
But yeah, like
and didn't.
Dick Cheney, Rush Limbaugh.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the list goes on.
Limbaugh
and on.
Because he had anal somethings. Warts?
I think he had fissures or I don't know what they
were. In other words, although most of us think he's a perfect
a-hole.
Well, he's not. He's a toe, but he's not a perfect.
Yeah, right.
Well, here's what Newt said in 1985 in the Wall Street Journal about dodging the draft. Part of the question I had to ask myself was what difference I would have made. What does that mean? Does he think...
That he was going to, save everybody?
Or it didn't make any difference one way or the other.
Oh, God.
I bet it made a lot of difference to Vietnam vets.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah. So, what now for Herman Cain? Anybody have any comments? 313-298-WRIF.
Well, I'll tell you what.
What?
This next for Herman Cain. He's going to get some big job.
On Fox News.
Maybe on Fox News or with some big corporation. You know, they always go up. They always move up. But not in our minds.
And they always wind up to be multimillionaires. Well, by the way, the same thing could be true said of Bill Clinton and of John Edwards.
Yeah.
I mean,
speaking fees.
Clinton, though. Well, I was thinking more of the serial adultery and those things. I mean, did Bill Clinton really think that he could point this intern and
know
no one will ever find out about this?
I mean, you know, it's.
Have a cigar.
He was seriously delusional.
Yeah. But you know what? The biggest serial adulterer of all times in the White House was John F. Kennedy.
Oh, that's true.
I mean, he was...
But no one cares because he was kind of cool, right?
Yeah, well... But
I think Clinton was pretty cool, too.
But one of the things that he should have done, and the only thing I had any agreement with Herman Cain's pronouncements about all this goes back to what Kennedy should have done. He should have said, my personal relationships are none of your business.
Yeah.
It's between me and my wife. And this lawyer for Herman Cain said the stuff about the sexual harassment is one thing. A consensual relationship between adults is not the business of the media or whatever.
And that's what he should have said. Yep, he should have.
Yeah, but by then he would have said, no comment.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Can you imagine that, though? You'd think, for one thing, well, at least they didn't find out about the 13-year relationship and suddenly...
Bam! There she is!
It's all great fun, and it demeans, maybe deservedly so, but it demeans politics in general. I mean, if you're going to have electoral politics, if you're going to have everything that the model of what we learned in civics class in high school, first off, you got to get money out of politics, which is the key to it all. Secondly, you got to have like a 6-week campaign that begins, what would that be, in late September. Yeah, September, the middle of September to the beginning of November.
Sure.
All just public television. I don't mean like WTVS, but like NBC, ABC, Fox News.
Networks.
NBC networks and the cables. And have these guys do Lincoln Douglas debates and say, here's my position, and what have you. And none of this terrible advertising. I even wonder what kind of effect that has on anyone, you know?
All it does is drive us crazy, I think. You know, us as people who watch television.
Yeah, it makes me go get a beer.
Yeah, it drives people to drink.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, my.
What do I have something else paperclipped. Oh, that was the thing about, I didn't even say that. We did, about Newt Gingrich. I mean, what did someone said? He is a stupid man's idea of what a smart man is.
Wow, that's good. Yeah. I've been reading a lot of articles about his history lately. And
He's not admirable.
Not at all.
But one of the things that a lot of these folks that support him is they're about redemption. So now, finally, after all these affairs and all this corruption in Congress, remember he was dumped out of being the speaker. He was fined $375,000. I mean, I can't even begin to remember all of the misdeeds that this guy has and the absolutely horrible things that he has said. But now he's got finally settled on Callista, his wife.
Yeah.
Callista. Doesn't that sound like something you could catch? I'm sorry, if there's any Callistas out there, I was just being funny. It's a nice...
You didn't mean it.
No, it's a nice name.
These guys are like cockroaches. You know, you just really cannot get rid of them.
That's right.
Wow.
But take on it from you folks, 313-298-WRIF. There was a slut walk in, of all places, Singapore.
Singapore?
This is
a surprise.
Place that's wrapped real tight. Chewing gum, you get caned. I mean, they like whip you.
What's up with that? That's the strangest law.
Well, hundreds of people gathered at a park in Singapore on Sunday to protest sexual violence against women as part of the global slut walk movement.
And this has been going on. I know that it happened in L.A. You said Toronto.
Well, the event featured in Singapore live. I don't know why they, of all the ones around the world, they feature this one. But it's very unusual to have demonstrations there. They don't allow them. The event featured live music, speeches, and a woman's... What? Martial arts exhibition. Participants at the rally did not dress provocatively, as some activists have in slut walks in the U.S. and Canadian cities. The idea, said the woman who organized the event, was... You see why I'm not saying her name?
Yeah.
This is too much. I probably should, but I just can't deal with it. Just Google it. Singapore slut walk. You'll see what it is. The idea was not to vamp it up because women can get raped regardless of what they're wearing. We're trying to raise awareness against victim blaming and slut slamming. Slut walk marches have been held in cities around the world, including earlier this year in New Delhi and Sydney, Australia. The protest
Who thought of this? I love it. But
protests originated in China, where they were sparked by a police officer's remark that women could avoid being raped by, quote, not dressing like sluts.
Do people still really think this?
Well, I mean,
you know,
women today dress, you know, I mean, short skirts, low
I
cut.
Don't. Do I? I mean, really, I don't. Think about it. I'm like, don't. What is that face for?
Let's move on.
T-shirts and jeans are me.
Yeah. Usually.
Yeah.
But anyway, in Toronto and later Boston, several women marched in lingerie with the word slut painted on their bodies. That goes back to that quote that I often mention when we're talking about such things, that by this feminist manifesto, number one, men shall not touch anyone else without permission.
Yeah. Right.
And a lot of problems in the world be solved. I mean, no war.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And no sexual violence and what have you. And it's the idea that somebody was driven to rape because of a woman dressing provocatively is a load of crap.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's like men cannot control themselves.
Well,
you think they can't?
There's a certain amount. Come on.
A woman should be able to walk down the street naked without anyone touching them.
Yeah.
I mean, what is up with that?
Well, I know. And then in certain parts of the world, nudity is not as vilified as it is here in the United States, too. You know what I mean?
No. Where?
Well, like over in Denmark, I was in Amsterdam, yeah, I turned on the TV. It was like, wow.
Yeah. I mean, you have, you go to beaches and women.
Or beaches. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I mean, there's some, you know, tribes like in Africa and maybe Asia where no one is completely naked. Women, usually. Or
no one's, right.
Yeah. What were some other, but there's more. This is Night Call. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. And
you can call 313-298-9743.
So you're going off to Washington, D.C.?
I am going to D.C. in 2 weeks, but I'm not missing Night Call or anything like that. I'm going to go out for the rally and vigil march for Bradley Manning, who is the GI.
Right.
Who, what's the word I'm trying to use?
WikiLeaks?
No, WikiLeaks, yeah. He basically...
He's accused of being the person who handed over to, I'm Julian Assange.
Assange, yeah.
All of the material that made up the WikiLeaks that exposed everything that the State Department.
And more.
Yeah. But a lot of it was just the, 95% of it was just the daily comings and going, the machinations of the empire abroad, where we shouldn't be. And they say this endangers American lives all over the world. Yeah, well, no one's been hurt at all, neither Americans nor anyone else. But what it's really shown is just how duplicitous American foreign policy is.
Whistleblower. That's what I was trying to think of. Yeah, accused WikiLeaks of whistleblower. I know. Yeah. Geez, and it was right in front of me.
That
so.
Was a joke.
Oh, yo, Peter. Oh, God. Oh, sometimes.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so there's a rally in March, Saturday, December 7th. There's a vigil, and you can attend the hearing on Friday. I don't know if I'm going to get to D.C. in time for that, but I'll be going to that rally in March and then flying back, doing 24 hours in D.C. and coming back, and I'll be able to report to everyone how it went.
Yeah, I wonder.
The whole thing is that he has a pre-trial hearing
on
the 16th.
You can go to BradleyManning.org. Now, a lot of people have said, whatever happens to him, he deserves. Well, there is a thing called innocence till proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And Bradley Manning has been virtually in solitary consignment for 18 months.
Yeah.
And this is a fairly young man. Like I think he's 22 or 23.
His 20s, yeah.
Something like that. And this already is cruel and unusual punishment to him. So, I mean, you can say, whatever happens to him, I don't care. It's not about the nature of the crime that the Constitution guarantees a certain set of behaviors on the part of the judicial system. It, no matter what it is, whether it's somebody that's a traffic ticket or a serial killer. Now, none of us have any sympathy. Sometimes we don't have any sympathy with jaywalkers, but certainly we don't have any sympathy. with serial killers or people like that. But when you start to allow the guarantees to fray because the crime, particularly the crime that's assumed in advance, the guilt of the crime is assumed in advance, we're starting to really fray the Constitution. And governments are really dangerous. Yeah, 99.9% of them throughout history have been authoritarian. And even ones like ours have so many aspects of authoritarianism to it that they have to be kept in check. And that's why the Founding Fathers had all those built-in checks and balances, which, again, have frayed considerably over the years.
If you go to bradleymanning.org, you can check it all out. There's a lot of resources, news, and you can get involved if you are, on his side.
Well, one of the things, too, a lot of things are happening. All of a sudden, in fact, I wanted to say, welcome to Occupy Night Call.
Yes. Yeah. We are, again, occupying.
Because a meteoric rise and almost a similar fall out of the media, at least. Because all of these Occupy movements are still going on, except most of them have moved inside. Some of them are being moved out, as you were saying.
Yeah, D.C., I think, is being disassembled, and that's putting it nicely tonight. I need to check on that because I heard that the pepper spray was a coming.
Yeah, and in Boston, they were trying to build permanent units there.
I know. You've got to love these people.
Yeah. Right. But what is happening, this was a kickstart for the challenge to the power of money and how it's distributed in this country and around the world. So this is the most significant political movement in a generation. And whether you directly took part in it, which probably is a minority of people, because the minority of people take part in all social movements. It doesn't matter whether it's the union movement or the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the Revolutionary War movement, whatever. I mean, unless you start having a civil war and then you have, draft hundreds of thousands of people. But these movements usually are carried out by a core of active, committed, visionary people. And that's not to say that they're forcing their views on people, because generally when something comes to the fore and really becomes like official policy or transforms the culture, it has the majority of people. I mean, things like gay marriage, which, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, about 18% of the people supported it, and now over 50% of the people support it. Apparently not the mayor of Troy.
Oh, yeah, of Troy, Michigan. Boy, she's a real treat, isn't she? Yeah. Oh, my
gosh. She's a teabagger.
She's big time into that.
She's fought millage increases in Troy for the library. Hell with it. Let it close.
I mean, really,
And
it's a read. So recently on her Facebook page, she said something about the queers in New York.
Yeah, she said, maybe I won't go to New York City anymore because they allow the queers to marry.
My jaw dropped when I read this.
Yeah, because you wonder, what year is this?
Really?
I mean, have people learned nothing? I mean, have people still, and these are the kind of people, the contentious people that create the kind of social strife and problems that make life difficult for people to live in. Because, I mean, certainly if you're the victim of a slur, like a gay man or woman, that's the most hurtful and the most dangerous, because, you can still get hurt, physically hurt or financially hurt, by being gay in this society. But it makes, it affects all of us. It's just kind of shameful, and particularly
an
elected official. Yeah. I mean, she said, I wasn't even running for office then. So in other words,
that's
excuse. Yeah, I could say, I mean, she didn't even say, well, she said, now I'm the mayor of all the people. Including the queers. She didn't say that.
I know, but she is just absolutely horrible. And I cannot believe that the people of Troy elected this woman.
Yeah, I don't know. I was actually
Troy, what did you do?
I was actually inadvertently at a election party for her opponent. I mean, I was just happened to be at the same restaurant after playing handball. And so they were getting all ready to celebrate, and this piece of work winds up triumphant.
Yeah, I know. Well, and it's caused her a little bit of controversy, but she said, she believes that marriage is between a man and a woman. She's got that whole thing down. But to say, listen, I wasn't even mayor when I wrote that on my Facebook page, that's the worst argument I've ever heard.
Yeah, and
she's worse than I even thought before.
And if someone said to me, I think that marriage is between a man and a woman, I'd go, yeah. Like, so what? I don't care what you think. Right? I mean, but just don't try to force people that don't agree with you not to have the same sanctity of law and protection of, their union under the law and what have you. I mean, and the best way, just like we always say, don't believe in abortion,
don't have one.
You know, think marriage should be between a man and a woman? Go for it.
Yeah, enjoy.
Yeah, enjoy. Just stop making other people's lives miserable.
Or your business, because really, it's none of your business.
Let's take we usually go to a break first, but we got a call here from Don in Sterling Heights. Don, hi. It's Peter and Julian.
Hi, Peter, Julian. What's going on?
Hi,
how you
Don.
Doing? What's up?
You made the comment earlier about the justice system for the military. Having served myself, I mean, it's a little different. You get in trouble, and there is no innocent until proven guilty. They're guilty until they charge you with it. It's pretty much the way it boils down.
Okay.
Now, that's what's happening
it's
with Bradley
guilty
Manning.
Until they charge you with it. And
I'm not surprised by it at all. But to be honest, in his case, he signed a non-disclosure agreement. You make the mistake of breaking that, pay the consequences like a grown man and be done with it.
Well, he's going to pay the consequences somehow. But you know what? He's also heroic, because sometimes whistleblowers are heroic.
But here's the thing, Don. He hasn't had a trial yet. I mean, that's his accusation. I don't know. That's the accusation against him. Did he do it? Is he going to say, I didn't do it, and this is all a big mistake, and here's my defense? Or is he going to say there was a necessity defense, and it's protected under United Nations or U.S. constitutional thing? We don't even know. But to hold somebody in the conditions that he did, to the point where other countries were sending protests to the United States about his treatment in solitary confinement and keeping him without clothing and what have you, I mean, that violates the Geneva Accords.
Guy, this guy's a traitor. They're not going to think about it.
Well, wait. But you know that's a harsh word, and that's not what he's charged with. He's not charged with treason, and again, he is innocent till proven guilty. And I mean, what if it turns out that in fact he didn't do it? You don't know that he did it, right?
Well, then so be it. The military will admit they made their mistake.
Right. Well, but in the meantime, you're calling him a traitor. You're saying whatever he gets, he deserves.
Well, I'll be at his hearing. I'll let you know.
Yeah,
how
I mean,
goes.
Why wasn't he? Whatever happened to the idea of a speedy trial?
You don't get that in the military. The UCMJ is completely separate from the civilian justice system.
Yeah, I understand that.
Clearly.
So you can keep somebody around 18 months in solitary confinement. If so, there's something drastically wrong with
the United States Military
Justice Code.
Does say he's not guilty, right?
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Was he harming the United States? You know, that's an interesting concept, the United States or America.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that all mean? You remember the conservatives used to have during Clinton, where they had their shorts all in a knot the way they do with
dog
their
on a bone.
Yeah, they had bumper stickers out say, "I love my country, but I don't trust my government."
Yeah.
So the idea, for instance, I mean, sometimes people think any criticism of U.S. policy, and particularly military policy, is treasonous. But then you got a guy on the right, like Ron Paul, that says these wars that Bush started were illegal and unconstitutional.
Yeah. Close all the bases.
Close all the bases, bringing them all home, overturn the Patriot Act. This is Ron Paul. This is, like a right-wing libertarian conservative. So if a left-winger says that, he's a traitor. If this
says that he's a hero.
He's
a quirky guy, yeah.
He is quirky. All right, I've got so many things here, and we want you in on this. 313-298-WRIF. Did you just give me this thing, record jump in carbon emissions in 2010?
It did.
You know, that sounds, here.
We were getting green.
Yeah, well, I thought, as I said, that people can go, "Ooh, I'm turning off this program." Record jump in carbon. Well, if I came over to your house and said, "Hey, you had a carbon dioxide leak that you didn't know about it somehow,"
you'd pay attention.
Yeah, you'd pay attention. Well, that's what's going on here. Global emissions of carbon dioxide from fossil fuel burning jumped by the largest amount on record last year, upending the notion that the brief decline during the recession might persist through the recovery. So we're slowly choking ourselves to death. I mean, I don't think. Yeah.
With all the awareness, that's. I just can't even believe to read this article, because you would think that things would be improving, Peter, but no. Because
this is like telling
big industry.
This is like telling a smoker that you get cancer from smoking cigarettes, and then you're out. What the hell? I don't care. But emissions rose 6% in 2010. And let's see. Scientists with the group said the increase, a half a billion extra tons of carbon pumped into the air, was almost certainly the largest absolute jump in any year since the Industrial Revolution began in the late 18th century.
Shameful. Shame, shame, shame.
But here is what two points that I thought in this was extraordinarily interesting. One, the combustion of coal represented more than half the growth in emissions, according to this report. Now, I don't know if you've seen these ads for clean coal.
An oxymoron. The first time I saw that, and they showed this, they have this music that's all serene, and they showed this country scene, maybe a little Babbling Brook or something like that. Clean coal, my ass.
The increase solidified a trend of ever-rising emissions that scientists fear will make it difficult, if not impossible, to forestall severe climate change in coming decades. You know, I get the feeling that when I say that, it's like saying fire. It's that all of us ought to run out of our house.
Or four.
Yeah, but it doesn't have that kind of impact on us. But here we go. Yeah, all right, sure. The United States, we're not number one.
We aren't.
Number two. Well, that's good. No, China's the number one polluter of carbon into the atmosphere. But here's the other part of it. Scientists say the rapid growth of emissions is warming the earth, threatening the ecology, and putting human welfare at long-term risk. Don't some of you have children? And I mean, you know, I don't know why I'm saying it like this. It's not like nobody is, caring or anything. I mean, because, if you said to me, yeah, you're right, Pete, what should we do tomorrow?
What's your answer?
Yeah,
right?
Right. I mean, you can say, you can join in an environmental group. That's at least part of it. But here, their increasing urgent pleas that society find a way to limit emissions have met with sharp political resistance in many countries, here from the Republicans, of course, including the United States, because doing so would entail higher energy costs. But the new figures show. But wait. Oh,
what?
Stop the show here. That's why it's good to read, because you can stop and think about this.
True. Instead of a 30-second piece on something.
Because doing so would entail higher energy costs. You know what? And what it means is...
the companies will have to pay more.
Yeah.
Because they have tighter controls.
And then they'll pass it along to us.
Yeah.
And then that'll make the economy do worse, because it'll be... This is all. So this is what I always refer to as capitalist blackmail.
And a cyclical mess.
Yeah. Do you want to pay more and or lose your job? Or do you want to be poisoned? Which of those three alternatives?
God.
Well, here's the deal. Here's a fourth alternative. Lower profits for these polluters. Rather than calling them energy companies like the Koch brothers, the K-O-C-H brothers, it does sound like Coke dealers, right? Wouldn't you imagine
Coca-Cola.
The Koch brothers.
Like a cartel, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Scarface.
So they're not going to, what it should say, because doing so would entail higher energy costs, what it could say would, that it would entail lower energy profits for the big corporations. All right. Your thoughts on this, and when we come back, what do you want to talk about?
I think we should talk about what our callers want to talk about. Got them on hold, and you can call, too.
That's good enough. What about Sled Walk? I mean, I'm always...
Sled Walk! I think I'm going to start one in Detroit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because...
Maybe I'll dress like a slut for one day, Peter. We'll get a picture of it.
Okay, on our Facebook page. Go to that. Got a lot of great stuff on the Facebook page, and they got Jalene's new column in the Macomb Monthly,
Monthly. Yeah.
Facebook.com/Night Call. Right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Trojan Man.
Attention, pleasure seekers. Trojan Bearskin Condoms are bringing couples closer than ever before. At an amazing 40% thinner than our standard condoms, couples are literally singing their praises.
Irresistible closeness. Yeah. We're in passion and harmony.
Wow.
Together as one, more connected than ever before.
Now that's pretty close.
Trojan Bearskin Condoms with triple tested quality. Trojan, America's number one most trusted condom brand.
Can't wait to get it on.
Looking for the perfect holiday items this year? Don't look any further. PersonalCreations.com is the place for the most special holiday decor, accessories, and gifts. And right now, you can get 20% off all Personal Creations unbeatable holiday items. Plus, everything can be personalized. That's right, you can add a name, photo, special message, and more. It's fast and easy to order, and you'll get 20% off everything. Just go to PersonalCreations.com, look for the star in the upper right corner, and enter the secret code HURRY. That's PersonalCreations.com. Code HURRY. PersonalCreations.com. Secret code HURRY. Do you know someone who's having a birthday this month? Don't let the date sneak up and catch you unprepared. Have ProFlowers send beautiful birthday flowers. They make flower deliveries easy and affordable. And get this incredible radio special. Yours right now. 100 stunning birthday blooms plus a free glass vase for just $19.99. Play it smart. Go online to ProFlowers.com. Look for the microphone in the upper right corner and enter the secret code FAST. Why overpay at a florist when you can get huge savings on one full 100 stunning birthday blooms for just $19.99 at ProFlowers. They'll even throw in a free vase. With a deal like this, you can take care of all the important people in your life and schedule that special birthday delivery weeks in advance. But hurry, this $19.99 birthday deal won't last forever. And the only way to get it is to go to ProFlowers.com. Look for the microphone in the upper right corner and enter the secret code FAST. One more time, write it down. ProFlowers.com. Secret code FAST. Got it? ProFlowers.com. Secret code FAST.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, these braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez-Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
Yes.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
That's 313-298-WRIF,
313-298-9743.
And by the way, I think I've said that before, that was the Reverend Jesse Crawford. The title was self-assumed. And he was the stage announcer for the old MC5 band and that was recorded live at the old, everything's got to have old in front of it, the old Grandy Ballroom.
just say Grandy Ballroom.
In 1968. And a lot of that activity, and they were the band of a radical left group called the White Panthers, who supported the Black Panthers back then. And a lot of the folks, including John Sinclair, his wife Lenny Sinclair, lots of other people, they lived in a house, a communal house, the way people used to do that thing. On Hill Street. And they're having a Hill Street reunion this coming Friday, I believe.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. And so it would have to be, you'd really have to know about it all. To want to go. I mean, it's history in and of itself. But if you're interested in that, I can send whoever is interested. Yeah, if you write me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Didn't you live there, Peter?
No. N-O. A lot of stuff going on, by the way. Oh, well, let me just sum up and encourage you to call. We were talking about the international slut walks. These are where women, in many cases, dress very scantily and say they have the right to walk and dress anywhere they want. And guys, keep your hands to yourself. What's that band?
The Georgia Satellites.
Georgia Satellites, yeah. Keep your hands to yourself. Because a police officer a few years ago in Toronto said that women could avoid being raped by not dressing like sluts. I wonder what they think, this jerk off thinks about women that are 80 that are raped
And, yeah, no doubt.
And children that are raped and all of this. You know?
Yeah.
What a stupid, insensitive thing to say.
Absolutely. But,
so this is like an international movement. We're also talking about Herman Cain, that piece of work.
Oh, boy.
The performance artist, formerly known as Herman Cain.
He suspended.
Yeah.
What the hell does that mean?
And he says, I'm at peace with my wife. She is at peace with me. Anybody really think she's at peace with him?
Whatevs.
Exactly.
He is so cut off, man.
Yeah.
You know?
And what else? Oh, yeah. You're going to the rally for Private Bradley Manning.
I am.
The GI who's accused of providing the material for WikiLeaks that exposed what the United States does in its diplomacy all around the world. No one was harmed because of it, and essentially what it does was just shows how duplicitous the United States works abroad. Don said that he was a traitor, he deserves whatever he got. Jalene and I said, I got the guy hasn't even tried yet. We don't even know if he's going to defend himself, saying he didn't do it. He did do it because, you know, there was a necessity.
Well, I don't think I'm going to be flying in soon enough to go to the hearing, but David Rovics, our friend, the singer-songwriter, will be there, and he's going to be at that hearing. So I'm going to get, like, the inside lowdown on what goes on inside that courtroom at Fort Meade.
That's good.
Yes.
And there is, let me see if I can quickly switch here. Yeah, to my website. Oh, it says this Sunday's guest. This is at 1 a.m. to be announced.
Is it a secret?
No, I forgot to put it on.
Oh, okay.
There's a number of things happening. Still, even though all the Occupy movements, with a few the cops cleaning up, if you will, a few cities.
D.C. right now, there were about a dozen arrests, last I heard.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Occupy movements are still going on, and the cat is out of the bag. The challenge, the power of money, the inequitable distribution of wealth in this country and throughout the world, is not going to be able to be, I'll mix all sorts of metaphors. The toothpaste is not going to be able to be shoved back
into the tube, right.
Yeah. So all sorts of things are going on. They're still Occupy Detroit, even though they're not encamped any longer at Grand Circus Park. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and you can click on the Occupy Detroit website. There's an Occupy Detroit Facebook.
Yeah, there's ongoing discussion.
And one thing. Join it. You know, I don't even want to talk to any of you students anymore. There's not about 10,000 of you at this demonstration. Here, your choice. In fact, it says it on my website. Join the movement to cancel student debt. Oh, man, here's a typo here. It says, join the movement to cancel student.
Oh, no, not the students, their debt.
Yeah, to cancel student debt or leave school owing the bankers tens of thousands. Because, I mean, as with credit card debt, essentially it's middle class and working class and poor people indebted to ultra-rich people, right?
Yeah.
So there, about the student debt, there's going to be a rally on the Wayne State University campus on the Gullen Mall, which is the central mall there, this coming Thursday, December 8th, noon to 2 p.m., march and rally to cancel student debt. Now, and you say, whoa, what about all these banks that are holding, you know, that note? Too effing bad.
Yeah. Well, they've been bailed out once, right?
Yeah, they've been bailed out once. We found out just recently it was as much as $7.7 trillion. Yeah. And these banksters, I mean, is there, you know, at no point are they going to have to pay for the economic crimes that they've committed that begin as economic crimes and then wind up destroying families, communities, you know, people's plans, their dreams. And they're just, you know, they just remain rich as all hell. I was looking for this piece, and now it keeps running in and out of my brain.
Which one?
Well, one of the things is these banksters are rewarding themselves greatly again, but they're not doing it with cash bonuses, which sometimes the bonuses are like 100,000 or a million or something like
millions.
Yeah,
right?
Millions, and they're going to be less. They're just giving them stock. So stock that's worth $20, you know, if this economy comes back, it'd be worth $70.
Yeah, true.
You know, so they're making a lot of money, but this is incredible. One of the major banksters, Citigroup, is got off with this fine for $285 million, a settlement between Citigroup and the Securities and Exchange Commission, that they allowed this company to settle case, the bank to settle case, without admitting they had done anything wrong.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. The agency contends that it must settle most of the cases because it does not have the money or the staff to battle deep-pocketed Wall Street firms in court. You know what that sounds like? It sounds like Mexico and the narcotraficantes.
Yeah.
The government is not strong enough to take on a private enterprise. I mean, you know, either the drug cartels in Mexico or the banks here. That they've got more money than the government. They've got our money, of course, but they got bailed out for 7.7.
Holding us hostage.
Yeah. But according to the Securities and Exchange Committee, Citigroup stuffed a $1 billion mortgage fund that it sold to investors in 2007 with securities that it believed would fail. They misrepresented them. So they would say, oh, yeah, these are great, these bundled subprime mortgages.
Yep.
And, I mean, even if all that is kind of a mystery to you, and it's kind of a mystery to me in a lot of ways.
Well, it's amazing how people blame it on people.
Yeah. Oh, they shouldn't have taken the loan out.
Not on the companies, yeah. You know?
But it would, let me start that sentence again. They had a $1 billion mortgage fund that it sold to investors in 2007 with securities it believed would fail so that it could bet against its customers and profit when the values decline. Isn't this called criminal fraud?
Sure is.
I mean, how do they get off with $285 million settlement? You know, one of these guys got it in their front pocket.
They're all in it together.
Yeah. I mean, these are criminal offenses. So this judge, this wonderful judge, this federal judge, Judge Jed S. Rakoff of the United States District Court in Manhattan said he wouldn't allow the settlement to go on because he could not determine whether the agency's settlement with Citigroup was fair, reasonable, adequate, and in the public interest. Guess what? It's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Here's what it should be. Okay. We don't want to collapse Citibank, but what we're going to do, you guys are going to be making the CEO about $150,000 a year from now on. Instead of 15 or 18 million. They're not going to be any of these big bonuses. You guys are going to make about 75,000. They said, well, they'll all quit. You know, adios, MF.
Yeah, right. get in line with everybody else who's out of work, right?
And, well, I don't think they would because they wouldn't, you know, whatever they're making would be more than zero. But the idea is there would be a lot of other people that'd be willing immediately to step in. And could they do any worse? Could they be more greedy? Could they be more avaricious? That's the same as greed. I just, you know.
You just wanted to use it.
Yeah.
Big word.
I never graduated college. So.
Big words with Peter Werby.
Yes, I'm an autodidact.
I love that. I remember one time you said that to me. I had a long time ago. I had to look it up.
Yeah. Self-taught. Yeah. Always, feel inadequate.
No.
So you have to use big words.
Yeah. It's kind of like that whole guys with their big trucks and truck nuts.
Let's move on. 313-298-WRIF. Here, let's get some calls in.
Yes.
In Pontiac, you're going to have to pronounce your name. Is it Reese?
Yeah, it's Reese.
Okay, that was easy enough. Hi, Reese.
Yeah, hi.
What's up?
You were talking about the carbon emissions earlier. I wanted to comment on that.
Sure, please.
Well, I like that I get to talk about this right after you talk about the whole multinational corporate scheme to, you know, rob us of our money.
Right.
It's the same thing with the carbon emissions, man.
What do you mean?
Well, first of all, we produce carbon when we live. So to exist is to be taxed.
Wow.
I mean, that's
you mean
the,
like,
the result of it.
Wasn't it Reagan or somebody that said the trees emit carbon?
Well, what? Reagan was an idiot then because it does the exact opposite. We emit carbon and plants breathe it.
Okay.
So to be green, if you want to be green, we need more carbon emissions.
Wow, man.
I don't know, Reese.
I don't know.
What do you mean more carbon emissions? You know, the kind of carbon emissions that are going into the atmosphere are what's going to eventually choke the planet.
They're poisonous.
Well, are we talking about dioxide or monoxide?
Wait a minute here.
Let's get out our periodic table of elements, Peter.
Yeah, I'm not.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to complicate things for you.
No, you didn't.
Well, I'm not.
It's not complicated. It's what you're saying is a bit confusing.
Yeah, no, what, here's, what, here's nice. What I'm saying. The majority, the vast overwhelming majority of climatologists and scientists that deal with this stuff say that human carbon emissions, not you and me breathing in and out,
right.
but burning fossil fuels is choking off the planet, creating this major climate change that's going to do incredible damage to the planet. You don't accept that?
Well, yeah. Burning fossil fuels and all that is definitely polluting the earth, but it's not making the same carbon emissions that we make.
No, you're absolutely right.
I'm sure you've read that, you know, cow farts are killing the planet. Well,
yes,
I see the problem with that.
Well, I mean, there probably are too many cows on the planet, too. All right, Reese, thanks for all that.
Geez.
We do appreciate that. Here is Tristan in Dearborn. Hey, Tristan, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
Hi, Tristan.
First of all, I would like to say, Jolene, I'm glad to hear that you're joining us cooks in the culinary program.
Thank you. Thank you. And are you a chef?
Yes, actually, I'm going for a culinary program myself.
Really? Excellent. Wonderful.
Where?
Henry Ford Community College.
Okay. Okay.
They've got a good little restaurant out there.
Yep, 5101.
Yeah. That's cool. the name of it?
I'll have to try it.
Yep, that is the name of it.
Yeah, okay. So what's up?
You had commented earlier about the mayor of Troy.
Yeah.
On the whole aspect of not wanting to go to New York for reasons I'm not going to mention.
No, she said.
Well, she says because the queers can get married there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I look at it this way. If a person is happy with another person, be it male or female, then you know what? What's the problem? If they want to get married, let them get married.
Agreed. Couldn't agree more.
Well, yeah. That'd be the simple way to look at it, and that would be the way that we could all get along, Tristan. But these people cite the Bible, for instance. Almost always. Sometimes it's just cultural, you know?
Yeah, sometimes it is, but oftentimes it is that old Bible.
Yeah, I mean, we always talk about, guys say, when I think about what they do, it just makes me sick. And we say, stop thinking about it,
you pervert. Yeah, but when it's two chicks, ooh, baby,
ooh. Yeah, they're lined up at that section of the porn
the porn store.
And it's... You know, it's sad the way that people still think about that in this day and age. Right?
I know.
Well, you know what, though? Just, I mean, I agree, but the times they are a-changing, as some guy once sang.
And there's always going to be a percentage of people against it. I just hope that decreases.
Well, it doesn't matter. Whenever we've talked about these things, we remind people that up till 1967, there were states that forbid interracial marriage, what they called miscegenation. There was laws.
And I sent you that article about, was it Kentucky?
You didn't send it to me, but I saw it.
Okay.
And there was a church that said they would forbid interracial couples from...
Like now?
Now, today, from praying at their church. And you know what? I guess they probably have every right to do that. And why I didn't say that right out is because if there's public accommodations involved, then the state licenses it, and then they can't do it. But I think it is just such a last ditch,
racist deal. Effort.
Yeah, yeah, and people are genuinely pretty much shocked. I mean, it could have been, we actually could have had two black candidates if Herman Cain could have kept it in his pants.
or if he wasn't so dumb.
Yeah, well, he was.
Sorry. He's a smart business guy, don't get me wrong.
No, he's pretty dumb.
And he shouldn't run the...
What do you think about Libya? Well, you're talking
Libya? Can I get a drink of water?
Yeah.
You know, I swear, I posted on Facebook that day, I said... major announcement. I know more about Libya than Herman Cain, but I guess that really shouldn't shock you.
But a lot of those Republican candidates really aren't known for how bright they are. And I mean, you know, what's her name? Michelle Bachmann thought that Concord and Lexington were in New Hampshire rather than in Massachusetts. You know, I mean, they are pieces of work.
Yeah.
I mean, and it says something to the nature about the nature of this country when the political system is just riven with such dunces.
Yeah, you know? They're like an off-Broadway show. Even though I love Broadway, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, they're good. They're good. I mean, they've gotten, the debates have gotten incredible ratings. And I talked to these people that are liberals. I said, you watch those things?
The Freak Show.
They say it's hilarious.
It's really funny. It is.
Oh, you watch it?
No, I've seen just maybe
clips.
I mean, yeah, clips. And that's all I need. I would never torture myself and sit through one of those.
Yeah.
There's so many other great things you can be doing with your life.
All right, thank you very much, Tristan. We're going to take a break, but Kim from Highland wants to talk about Bradley Manning, and Matt from Plymouth thinks we're whining about Wall Street making money.
Wow.
We'll be right back and get their calls on the air.
And
yours too.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Hi, I'm Will Elias, the short sale expert and owner of Elias Realty. Can you believe we're near the end of 2011? The holidays are just around the corner. You know what else is around the corner? December 31st, 2012. That's the expiration date of all the programs that enable me to get you out of your upside-down mortgage and into the home of your dreams for half the price, without owing any taxes, without destroying your credit and your debt. Say it with me now. Gone. Elias Realty will spend more time, resources, advertising, and money towards selling your home than anyone else, I guarantee it. My team has sold millions and millions of dollars worth of real estate this year alone. Look, if you write a monthly mortgage payment to Citi, HSBC, GMAC, Wells Fargo, ASC, Bank of America, Chase, CCO, just to name a few, stop what you're doing, put my number in your phone, and call me right now. 877-CALL-WILL. Again, that's 877-CALL-WILL. You want that home sold? You know the number. 877-CALL-WILL.
Christmas is almost here, and I have the perfect gift idea. Huge, freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry's Berries for as little as $19.99. These berries are fantastic. Everyone on your holiday list will go crazy over these delicious treats. Who doesn't love giant strawberries dipped in chocolatey goodness? And starting at $19.99, it's yummy and affordable. But you can only find this amazing deal at berries.com. Click on the microphone in the upper corner and enter the secret code. Hurry! These giant berries are sure to impress everyone on your list. Dipped in rich chocolatey goodness and covered with gourmet toppings like chocolate chips, nuts, and swizzles. These huge strawberries are juicy and unbelievably delicious. Trust me, they will not disappoint. And with a deal like this, you'll want to give them to everybody. But hurry, this incredible deal expires Friday at midnight, and you can only find it at berries.com. Click on the microphone in the upper corner and enter the secret code HURRY. Don't wait, a deal this good won't last. Go to berries.com now and enter the secret code HURRY. That's berries.com, code HURRY.
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude, what happened to your face? I see one, two,
ow,
three, four, five, six.
Ow.
Dude, what is
ow
this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julian Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. There'll be a podcast of this show available at noon. That's about 12 hours and 4 minutes from right now. If you go either to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, lots of good stuff on there. You can see Jolene's new column in Macomb Monthly.
Yeah,
or
it's kind of an intro to the column, announcing that I'm doing the column.
Right. And do you have any, you don't want people to go to your, no, never mind.
Nope. Go to our Facebook page.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And what else? Oh, yeah. I just looked at my own page, my website, PeterWerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And I thought, oh, I don't have the guests up for this week that we'll be hearing in an hour. Mm-hmm. One of them is Richard Bach, who's written all this incredible stuff about Detroit.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, he's written about 30 books about Detroit. And
my gosh.
And some people think, well, that's really interesting, you know.
No, it is.
This guy is
Detroit
really.
Detroit history is fascinating.
And this is called Detroit Land, and it's something like movers, shakers, all this, and it's got everything from people you've heard of, people you've never heard of.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, no, it's really good. This guy is an incredible guest. Julie from Ann Arbor sent a notice of this lawsuit that someone named Blaine Coleman. Blaine Coleman tried to take out an ad on the Ann Arbor buses that was critical of Israel, and the bus company said, no, we don't want to
really?
Do it. Yeah, and all I got is the suit here, so it's way too long, that he said the advertisement would say, boycott Israel, boycott apartheid. And the Ann Arbor Transit Authority refused to run Mr. Coleman's advertisement, citing an advertising policy that the suit claims is unconstitutional on its face, and as applied. Now, I don't know what the deal is with bus companies, public transportation, that doesn't, that can choose what sort of political message. Yeah, content. That's usually not too good. But I don't know. You know, on
one. That's pretty strong words. I can see why they would be afraid of it as a business, but, you know.
Yeah. All right, well, let's try this. Here is Matt in Plymouth, who thinks we're a couple of whiners. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Not necessarily you guys, but you guys do. You're the lefty guys. I'm the righty guy.
Oh.
But, I'm happy that you guys have your opportunity to speak your side, because that's what this country was made of, you know, having having two different parties and being able to speak your mind.
And also the fact that 90%+ of political talk shows are on the right. So we're a very small group of.
We're happy though. But go ahead. Yeah. What's on? What's up?
Well, I heard you saying about the stock prices, about the $20 if it goes to $70. And it hits kind of home with me. I'm in the car business. I work for a Ford dealer. And back when Alan Mulally got his bonus and he got the stock options and made it just a killing on the stock options.
Right.
Everyone was whining and crying that why does he get so much? Why doesn't he give it back to the workers? So on and so forth. He actually took, his money was on him. He actually had to work for that. Like me, I always use this phrase, I'm a car salesman.
Okay.
So if I don't move my feet, I don't eat. So if I don't talk to you, if I don't sell you a car, I don't make any money. Same with him. If those stocks that he got, the options, went to nothing, he would have nothing. But he actually worked hard. He turned the company around, not single-handedly, but
well, I was gonna say,
he had a lot to do with it.
But wait, before we go any further, Matt, we were talking specifically about who we've designated as banksters, the guys that created these financial instruments that, and probably in many ways, have hurt your business like everyone else's. I'm sure you had a down period, although Fords are selling well. You'd be happy to know that I have two Ford products.
You do.
Yeah. And that these guys who took $7.7 trillion from the Federal Reserve and are still laying people off, created these bad mortgages, lied to investors, then found themselves in a hole, had to get bailed out with your and my tax money, and now are richly rewarding themselves. I can't believe, no matter how far right you are, that you think that's a good idea.
No, I understand all that. But you also have to, there's also a moral obligation that people forget these days. You may have signed a bad mortgage, but that mortgage didn't say, hey, guess what? Your house is going to increase by 50% in 10 years. There's no law that said your house has to increase in value.
Yeah.
And with these people walking away from their mortgages and short selling their homes and then just going out and buying another one, it makes me sick, because I deal with credit scores all day long. And people that walk away from their homes, they can still get a brand new car, they can still get this, they can still get that.
Wasn't that
and they
good?
Just leave everything behind. And I'm forced, because I actually have a moral compass, that I pay my mortgage, that I pay my car payment, that I pay my credit card.
Well, so do I, and so do a lot of people, maybe even the majority of people. But when there's something that's large enough to actually qualify as social phenomena, I mean, if you have aberrant behavior, you know, like serial killers, although there's quite a few of them in the United States, that's totally aberrant behavior. But if you have a situation where there's mass number of people committing a variety of crimes, for instance, everywhere from white-collar crimes, which are the big crimes that set the context for the smaller crimes that we suffer directly if we, you know, live in a middle-class or working-class neighborhood, you know, B&Es and stuff like that. But if it comes in such widespread manner, there's something a little deeper to it than just individual choices.
I mean, that's irresponsibility.
Kind of, yeah, I mean, that's kind of like Newt Gingrich was talking about how he wants to get rid of these child labor laws so he can get 8- and 9-year-olds being janitors, because this will give people a work ethic. Like somehow that the mass amount of poverty, we're up now to 44% of the people in the United States are either poor or near poor, and in the richest country in the world. And he thinks that poor work habits are the result of this. Well, it's not the result of this. It's the result of millionaires like him just not doing things that, as far as I'm concerned, are illegal. And they're not, and they never pay the cost. I mean, think of the crimes that these people have committed. And you know what, Matt, you too have suffered, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, and to just to go back to real quick about the 99, the Occupy 99%, blah, blah, blah. You know, I have to work every day.
Yeah.
I don't have a big neck tattoo. I don't have stuff in my face. I don't complain.
What does that mean? What does that mean? What do you mean?
What are you talking about?
Stuff on your face.
Have you guys gone down and seen these? I work in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
I go down and I see these people in Ann Arbor that are the 99%.
Oh, wait. You're talking to these people. So,
right. Exactly.
You know.
That's my point. They're complaining. They're not, you can't walk into a place of business and expect, because you have your girlfriend's name tattooed on your neck or a ring.
Wait.
What century is this? Are you a prude? And Peter and I are those people.
I mean,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think you.
For one thing, if you you can see 100 people. And if you see one person with a tattoo on their neck, that's what stands out.
I have one on the back of my neck. I have them all the way down, all right? Does that make me a dirty hippie? Let me ask you that.
Radio.
Huh?
He says, you're on the radio.
So what?
it doesn't matter.
No, that's not true. And you know what? From time to time, I do television, too. And you know what? From time to time, I go down and I occupy. And from time to time, I fly out to D.C. and go to protests. But guess what? I work my ass off. I own my own house. I own my own car. I consider myself somewhat successful in the business. So can you be both?
Well, sure you can.
No, I want to hear it.
Oh,
Peter.
Okay, go ahead.
Can you be both?
It's definitely not a high percentage that walk around looking like that. And there's nothing wrong with looking like that. Express yourself the way you want, but don't complain when you don't get a job.
Wait a minute, you totally dogged
them, and now you're backtracking.
And plus, you're talking about men and women over 50 that are never going to work again. The unemployment rate has gone down because so many people have, according to the government, stopped looking for work. And you know what? They might as well stop looking for work, because very few of them are going to. You could say that, you know, that if you're really diligent, some individuals come up with it. But a mass unemployment and a sinking of wage standards and income, and, you know, it's real easy. You can be right-wing, left-wing, it doesn't even matter one little bit, Matt, and one little turn here or there, and suddenly you're applying for food stamps.
And you know what else, Matt? A little FYI here. My dad was a car dealer for many, many years, very successful car dealer, and I worked for him at that dealership with my tattoos, and he's a conservative, and he says, do your thing, girl.
All right,
I love you,
man.
The way you are.
Yeah.
He does not judge. Do not judge people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there is something... he's right, but it's irrelevant. I mean, if you have a tattoo on your face, you probably have less of a chance to get a job as a car salesman.
Yeah, well, not many people have that.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's it. I mean, that's the whole conservative mantra that those people are.
I know.
And then
it's
they,
awful.
And yeah, I mean, for one thing, if you're a photographer, remember I mentioned that I think on the air. That there was a photograph of somebody at Occupy Wall Street that had a sign, am I dressed too nicely to be on Fox News? In other words, let's see, where's a freak, you know?
Yeah, let's find the freaks and then make the world think that's all it's about are, you know, the alternative types.
And you know who always appear to be the biggest freaks? And that is young people, because when you're...
You're a little bit more free.
17 to 25 or 30, and the current style is, dreads even for white guys or...
I had dreads down to my ass, remember, Peter, when I worked here WRIF.
Yeah, but Matt said it's radio.
If it doesn't matter. I still did television, too.
I'm wearing a dirty sweatshirt.
I'm not going to talk about what I'm wearing.
Okay. Here is Kim in Highland, wants to talk about Bradley Manning. Go ahead, Kim, you're on the air.
I just want to say I think Bradley Manning and Julian Assange are heroes. Isn't Bradley Manning the guy who was downloading on the Lady Gaga, the helicopter pilots, shooting down all those innocent reporters?
I don't know whether he let those go. What he's talking about is that he's accused of smuggling out the material that became the WikiLeaks diplomatic messages that he's being charged now with. Had a Lady Gaga CD cover, and what was on there were these videos, among other things, of American troops just randomly shooting unarmed civilians down in Iraq. Yeah, well, a lot of people think, well, that's traitors. We shouldn't be able to see that. We should know everything about government. Government, probably the operations of government are about high percentage secret. And that's not what you can't make any decisions in a democratic society if all this stuff is what they say right in front of your face, but always behind your back, right?
Right. And that's the thing. Like, if you recall, Pat Tillman
in Afghanistan.
Yeah, they said it was enemy that turned fire. It was friendly fire.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It was.
So cover up, CSA, that's the name of it. All you got to do is go Penn State and places like that, Syracuse, and you see the way all bureaucracies protect themselves and they protect the higher-ups. I mean, look at the Catholic Church, right?
Yeah. We don't want to go there.
Okay. All right,
we don't. You're right.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is here's Paul in Sterling Heights. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
I need to testify, brothers and sisters.
Testify.
I need to testify.
Yeah.
I keep up on guys like Frank Luntz and Karl Rove. I mean, Karl Rove is a hell of a manipulator. And Frank, he knows how to spin some words, doesn't he?
He is the master.
These are Republican operatives, folks, if you don't know what they are.
So, anyhow, yeah. I don't know what happened. My parents met after World War II when they were carpooling on the way to Chrysler. You may as well consider me a member or a product of the assembly line. I have worked for Ford for 35 years, and I intend to retire.
Good.
But look, wasn't I fortunate? 1976, those jobs were all available.
Sure.
I just walked into an opportunity, and I took it, and I consider that luck. I consider myself the last of dinosaurs, folks.
The last of the Mohicans.
Yeah. So anyhow, I call my sister up and I tell her I'm ready to retire and all this shit. She said, "You make me so proud. You work hard for it." And I said, "Well, sis, you know, I'm the last of dinosaurs. I just got lucky." Well,
and it shouldn't be up to luck.
No,
yeah.
Wait.
You were there at the right time at the right place.
But here's the deal, okay? My sister, I don't know what happened. She's conservative.
Oh no.
That happens in the best. It happens in the best of families.
My whole family's conservative. I'm the lone liberal. Except I think I have some cousins who are liberal, you know.
Okay, now here's the deal. My sister will not accept that it was my luck. She says, no, it wasn't luck, it wasn't luck, it wasn't luck. And I said, well, it's luck to me. No, it's not luck, it's not luck, it's not luck.
What does she think it is? What does she think it is?
Oh, come on. If you read Lunch, you got to understand what made me successful was rugged independence.
Right.
And you know, hard work.
People I know, they got jobs in 1976. They just, a lot of them had what they called groove rooms. They would take all these multicolored floor mats and paste them up on this little room where they would just go in there and get high.
Really?
Well, in the plants, yeah.
I can't say I never saw that. I can't. But look, here's another thing about luck. I took the apprentice test. I passed it. My first month on the apprenticeship, I saw 3 industrial accidents, and I looked at my fingers, and I said, I want to retire with all these.
Yeah. Have you?
I got sober.
You got them all?
Oh, yeah, I got them all.
All right. That's what counts. And
I think he said so he worked sober. Is that what you said?
Yeah, he did. He did. All right, Paul, thank you very much. Thanks for the story. Appreciate it. You know, I forgot that on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, there is something happening on, what is today, the 4th? The 5th?
Oh, on the 6th.
Well, there's any number of things. Take Back the Capitol, the 99% Converge on Capitol Hill, December 5th through the 9th. And so I guess it started already, and there's this big lobbying and demonstration. So,
where is this?
In D.C.
Oh, okay.
In Washington. And usually you won't get any of this on the news, or maybe because, you know, all of a sudden they started covering this stuff.
A little more mainstream.
But you can go to, like, democracynow.org, and there's a way to join people. And then also on my website, this is the trippiest thing. Did you see this? Vatican priest says that yoga is satanic.
Well, there again, I'm going straight to hell.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I've got no chance, Peter.
I mean, the priest is an older man. And
this guy.
Doesn't look, can you see him?
He's creepy.
Well, yeah. I'm just arranging the screen for.
She's not creepy.
She is this just healthy, vibrant looking woman.
Yoga goddess.
Yoga goddess, yeah. And
look at him.
So, and this guy, Father Gabriel Amorth, 85 years old, also warned of satanic influence in the Harry Potter books. The controversial priest who has carried out more than 70,000 exorcisms in 25 years. Now, our radio talk show host colleague Mike Malloy, who has a commentary that you can link to on my site, he says this guy, that means a guy is doing did 2 and 3 exorcisms a day.
What?
You know,
this guy needs
great.
Something else to do.
Yeah, he needs a... Yoga is the devil's work, said Father Amorth. You think you are doing it to stretch your mind and body, but it leads to Oriental religions based on the false belief of reincarnation. In other words, you ain't going nowhere.
Yeah, well...
You're either coming up with the Big Daddy or you're going down.
I'd like to know where he's really going.
Yeah.
You get my drift.
Yeah. The priest whose favorite film is The Exorcist.
This guy's obsessed.
Yeah. Told a conference in Turin, Italy, in Harry Potter, the devil uses his powers of magic and evil.
Poor guy.
And he says, the Italian Yoga Association calls his claims outrageous. I agree.
And for yoga people, that's pretty big.
Yeah.
Outrageous is a pretty strong word.
I went way back. Yoga is not a religion, but a spiritual discipline.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, it is. It's a good path.
And it really does stretch your mind, my body and mind.
Yeah, yeah. I like Tai Chi because it's moving.
Right. Well, you're moving in yoga, Peter.
I know. But
you can't sit there still enough.
No, I know. I'm too ADD.
Which
means I should.
Minutes.
Let's see if we can get our pal Mike. I don't know. I don't think he swears, but let's see here.
Peter.
We can get this.
It's not allowed here.
No, I know. But this is Mike Malloy on this.
Okay, this is our friend, our talk show host friend, lives in Georgia, nationally syndicated. And this guy, you know, you listen to us, people write us, you two are a little harsh, you know, you're a little bit too, you know, overbearing. We are little baby kitty cats compared to this guy.
I don't hear him. Let me see.
You got to turn that up.
It leads to evil, just like reading Harry Potter. Oh, yeah.
You know, some of you scum suckers who send me your nasty emails because I think the Catholic Church is an organization of psychopaths and child molesters. I mean, what do you want as proof? What do you want as proof? Practicing yoga is satanic? Reading Harry Potter? You mean the millions of children around the world are now demon-possessed? You seen a picture of this guy? Son of a bitch. I'll tell you, the demons he's exercised have all gone into him. You ought to see a picture of him. Incredible. Father Gabriel said that the seemingly innocuous Harry Potter books convince kids to believe in black magic. And your religion convinces kids to believe in eternal damnation and hellfire and pain and death and demons and destruction and exorcisms!
This guy, man.
I love him.
Yeah. He said, Father Gabriel said, quote, "In Harry Potter, the devil acts in a crafty and covert manner, under the guise of extraordinary powers, magic spells, and curses." This is what the guy said. And as for yoga, yoga leads to, oh no, be still my beating heart. Yoga leads to Hinduism. And, quote, "All Eastern religions are based on a false belief in reincarnation." Well, don't you people believe that, Father Gabriel? I mean, didn't your Messiah?
Well, we were. That's the irrepressible Mike Malloy. Yeah. I think it's just MikeMalloy.com. And his little logo says, "Mike Malloy, because each time you listen to right-wing radio, God kills a kitten."
Oh, jeez.
He is a
good friend of ours.
He is out of control. But that's good. He's not, you can't get him in Detroit. Okay, we were talking about Jolene's tattoos, and also, was it Matt? Yeah, Matt said that part of the problem was that people get tattoos.
Stuff on their faces.
And that's why they can't get jobs, and that's why, by implication, that there's mass unemployment. Here's Brent and Wesley. Brent, hi. What do you think about tattoos?
I've got tons of tattoos. I'm a firm believer that ink is the most excellent thing you can do to your body.
I think it's very healing, and minor healing.
I do have to agree with them. If you get tattoos below the collar of a long sleeve shirt or above the collar of a dress shirt, you're not going to be able to get a blue collar job, because if you have to deal with people, they're going to see that and they're going to think less of you.
You mean a white collar job?
You mean white collar?
Even blue collar jobs nowadays.
Yeah.
Because to work at McDonald's, they have it's what it's called, an image standard. Huh. You can't have facial hair. You can't have tattoos on your face, your neck, or your back, your hands anymore. When you're at work, you have to take out your piercings.
Well, that's it. They even do that to some extent in radio on the streets.
Well, we got a lot of tattooed people here.
Here, yeah.
Including the man that makes the podcast happen.
Yeah, Jeremy.
He's major
and
tattooed pierced.
And all over the place. That's the good thing about radio. You can still have self-expression.
Yeah, and Jeremy just got a big promotion, as a matter of
fact.
And it's a pretty straight, you can imagine, it's a big media corp, not a big, medium or small media corporation, and so they're kind of conservative. Actually, I know a young guy that, this tall, extraordinarily handsome young man, and he got tattoos, like, on his neck and everything that are very visible. Because he said he never wants to be tempted to get into mainstream society.
Hilarious.
Okay, well, you sound like you're in a windstorm, so we're going to just say, Brent, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Anybody had that experience, got discriminated against because they had tattoos?
That's why I'm in this business, you know?
313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
I'll tell you, the only thing, someone came to me and said, hey, I'm 20 years old. I'm thinking about getting a tattoo. What do you think? I would, I probably would just say, I don't know. But, I mean, there are certain...
Or maybe get it in a place where someday, if you are going to get that job, there's a lot of places on your body. No one even knows, honestly, unless I wear my hair up.
Right.
No one can tell that I have any tattoos, and I have something like 18.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Let's see him.
Do you really want to?
Yeah, it's radio.
Right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Here you go.
Oh, my God.
All the way up.
All the way up. And,
Peter,
whoa.
You got a private show.
And all the way down.
And all the way down.
Wow. And the sun don't shine there.
Someone said, what is it? I have kanji, Japanese symbols. And yeah. Someone said to me, what does the last one say? It says, wow, you made it here. It really doesn't.
Those are all Japanese symbols?
Yeah.
Or Japanese
characters?
Yeah, they
all mean something different. You know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Folks.
A lot of politics in there.
Yeah.
You know?
Really?
You bet.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's
move
on.
Scary up here.
Here's Paul in Westland.
Can you go on?
Yeah. I'm flushing a little. Paul, let me see. Are you with me? Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air. Hey, Paul.
There?
Yeah.
We're here.
Okay. I guess for the show. I've been listening to the show for a long time. You bring up a lot of important parts in life and like in politics and stuff, so I thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Paul.
Yeah.
Okay, I had a job. You know, it's a crappy job, but I'm happy I had a job.
Yeah.
But I work at a private store. I work every night with the public. I got tattoos and piercings. I got piercings in my face. And I got piercings like tattoos people can see. I work with the public every night, and nobody complains.
Nobody complains?
Nobody complains. I want, like, there's guys at the car dealerships talking, like, all this crap about tattoos. Like, being out in the air, but somebody about tattoos and people have piercings in their face. And I'm complaining about it. I want to be a part of this, so I have to deal with people every day and night. Sorry for saying that. If I can say that.
Yeah, sure. No problem.
I work.
What kind of job you do?
I work at a party store.
In a what store?
A party store.
Oh, party store. Okay.
I sell beer and liquor.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, that shouldn't be an impediment there.
But I deal with people every night.
Yeah.
I got two pieces in my face. I got a whole bunch of tattoos.
Yeah.
And nobody, like, I deal with older crowds, younger crowds, and nobody else complains. And this guy was complaining about being in Ann Arbor and complaining about people having piercings in their face.
Yeah.
Nobody complains about this tattoo store, but I see every day and night.
Okay.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Join the Riff at Parkway Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram on Hall Road just west of Gross Beck in Clinton Township tonight, 5 to 7 p.m. Test your skills against Rock Girl Stacy. Score hockey tickets or a holiday ham from Dearborn Brand. It's all going down at Parkway with 101 The Riff.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? It could be a burglar. Burglars prefer to break in when they think no one is home and no one will stop them. Don't be an easy target for intruders. Protect your home with a free security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Pick up your phone now and get free hardware, free medical and fire alerts, and free activation. It's an $850 value. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer, at 1-877-653-8844. You'll get 24-hour protection, and there's no cost for parts or activation. Call now about a free security system monitored by ADT. Call 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge, 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions to this offer and protect your home license numbers. Call now, 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. In about 33 minutes, a couple of interesting interviews. One I've played before. It's an interview with a man that's written a book about Satchel Paige, the great baseball player that was pretty much confined to what was called the Negro National League back in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And finally, it began pitching when they integrated the major leagues
pitched. I can't remember. He was at least in his late 30s, maybe even his 40s or something. And I think he finally pitched a game when he was in his 50s.
Really?
Yeah, he was one of the greatest fastballers of all times. Incredible player. And by the way, the other interview is with Richard Bach, who has got a new book out called Detroitland. A lot of stories, including he wrote a book about Turkey Stearns and the Detroit Stars, which was a Negro National League team that used to play out in Mack Avenue and had some of the greats as well that you know could have played on any major league team, except of course they couldn't. We were talking about tattooing, and also piercing. And here is something you might want to... I took this completely wrong. This group is taking AK-47s, did you see this? And
I
fashioning
did.
It into jewelry, including earrings that cost $150,000.
What's up with that?
And let's see, they also have signet rings. These are
at 25 grand.
Yeah, yeah. Inscribed in each piece is a reminder of its deadly provenance. The serial number of the rifle that went into its production. So those rings, 25 grand. And the company's latest designs, a new series of earrings, are 23,000 a pair. A pair of men's oversized cufflinks, 35,000. This is, call it wearable art. And I'm thinking, this is really disgusting.
Yeah.
But then it turns out that the sale of the jewelry go to the Foundry 47 Foundation, a tax-exempt nonprofit organization which finances non-governmental organizations like the Mines Advisory Group, which in turn are contracted by Congo's government to destroy the weapon.
Yeah, so that's good.
Yeah, so far Foundry 47 has demolished about 6,000 assault rifles, and no word from Mikhail Klashenkov, the 92-year-old designer of the AK-47, about what he thinks of all of this.
I didn't realize he was still alive.
No. But it says he can lend his name to vodka, watches, and the like. So who knows? He's already done that. Well, all right. Let's get back to our phones. We were talking some about tattoos, asking whether you had ever been discriminated against because of it. Here's Dominic and Taylor. Hi, Dominic. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I got a comment and then a question.
Sure.
I've always had two jobs. One of them's been a tattoo artist in Romulus.
Uh-huh.
Cool.
I've worked as a union roofer for 2 years, and there was always, like, our boss had this weird thing with tattoos to where everybody could be on the roof, and we didn't do, like, shingle roofs. We did flat tar roof and Duralast. But everybody would be up there in shorts, no shirt, and boots, and I had to wear pants and long-sleeve shirts when it was, like, 130 degrees on a roof.
Wow. Because you had tattoos? I mean, I thought it was a union gig. What?
We did a lot at churches.
Yeah.
And the churches complained about it, so everybody that had tattoos had to cover them.
Really? Wow.
It was really weird.
Yeah. There is something, by the way, in the Jewish religion that you're supposed to go out just the way you came in, and so hence can't get tattoos. I don't know what that says about the required circumcision, but...
right.
Yeah, Orthodox Jews, for instance, never get tattooed. It's my understanding.
Didn't know. Well, that's not surprising to me at all.
Yeah. So no, that's pretty crazy. But maybe they said they wanted the job, right? So they had to do it. Yeah, I mean that's all. You know, back in like the 60s and the 70s, people that had long hair. Isn't there some? There's some song about, no long-haired freak need apply. What's that song?
Oh, yeah. Signs.
Signs.
Long-haired freaky people
Tesla?
Need not apply. Well, Tesla did it, but it was also done before Tesla covered it.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah. What?
Oh, I was just wondering if I was still on or not. I was going to ask another question.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Actually, the tattoo shop that I've been working at just opened another shop, and I was going to see if we could do a free plug or something.
Sure. Go ahead. What the hell?
It just opened up at Briarwood Mall. It's called the Unique Design.
Okay, you got a free plug. Let me tell you that you actually might benefit from a paid ad on WRIF. That's what pays our salaries. And I'll tell you, advertising, a lot of it goes by what they call the day part. So Sunday nights,
between 11 and 1
are pretty cheap. In fact,
because we're on late.
Yeah, we're on late, and it's Sunday night.
And so. We do have a lot of, we have the growing houses, we have the
yeah, I would say
tattoo shops. That's what kind of lands around here.
So think about that. Just call the WRIF main number. All right, thank you very much, Dominic. Appreciate your call. Here is our next caller, and it is Scott in Clinton Township. Hi, Scott. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter, Jolene.
Hi,
Scott.
I'm sorry, first-time caller, long-time listener.
Well, welcome.
Great.
What brought you
Good to be here. Oh, I just had a comment about Mike Malloy, who you just played.
We should tell people that right before the break, we had a little clip of Mike Malloy, a talk show host, nationally syndicated show. Who we love.
Yes, love, absolutely.
Yeah. And Mike, and first in 2000. Year 2000, Mike Malloy and myself was hired by the UAW, United Auto Workers, to host nationally syndicated talk shows.
The three of us.
Well, initially it was just me.
Right, right.
I brought you on.
You brought me on board.
I brought you on board. So that's where we know Mike from. Mike has continued with a nightly show. You can pick him up at MikeMalloy.com. But go ahead, Scott. I just wanted to fill people in.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah,
I just wanted to let the audience know. You said that he wasn't available in Detroit. You can stream his show online, and it's on satellite radio.
Sure.
On satellite radio, channel 127, Monday through Friday.
Okay, So, but the best place to listen to radio is right here.
Right here on WRIF. Never leave this band.
Ever.
Yes. All right, Scott, thank you very much. Some open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Fred in Detroit. Hi, Fred. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
Hi, Fred.
I was half asleep when I heard Mr. Right Wing Guy call in, but I just wanted to say that I seem to remember, just as in 1929, it was the supposedly morally upstanding, highly intelligent, clean-cut white guys that wrecked the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's the reason for mass unemployment.
Yeah, well.
But they always got to blame the hippies, you know?
Right. Well, they used to say during the 30s, there would be these rich people and these right-wing conservatives who would say anyone can get a job who really wants one. I mean, they would say that. I mean, and to some extent, it's almost irrefutable. You just want to shake your head and kind of move off in another direction, that someone could be that stupid. And I'm not saying, I'm not aiming this at Matt, but because he didn't say that. But there was that attempt to, and it always is, the big guys cause the problems. The big guys are always getting the credit for doing the good stuff when things are going well. And then they screw up royally. They start some war or they ruin the economy. And they say, it wasn't me. And they always wind up landing on their feet. Few of them go down.
To prison.
But most of them, no.
Do me a favor. Can we pot him up a little bit? I'm doing an experiment.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, that excuse, of tattooed people and people with piercings, that's akin to welfare queens, an army of welfare queens being a drag on the system.
Yeah.
Right.
Just one big outrageous lie.
Yeah.
Well, it's necessary because if you don't have these myths that the right wing puts forth, then you got to deal with reality. And reality wouldn't work well for their they're puppets for the corporations. And a lot of, it's different deals. I mean, certainly the right wing politicians are all just acting out the script for the big corporations. The individuals, I'm not ever sure what they're on about. I mean, ordinary working people that have right wing views, oftentimes it's just anger, resentment,
fear.
Stuff like that. Fear, exactly.
Lots of fear.
All right, Fred, you can go back to sleep.
All right.
No, you can't for 20 minutes.
20 minutes more.
Edward had called in, and we always have this issue. Sometimes people bring up that we're louder than the caller. So I was just wanting to see if you pushed him up a little higher. Edward, let us know if you
we're louder than the call. I'm looking at these bars going up and down. Here, you speak.
And they're the same, right?
They're the same.
The level. So he said that the callers are not as loud as us. So we'll see if that.
Yeah.
We'll see what we can do, Edward.
Here's something that you know, that the Democrats want to raise taxes on the millionaires, the ultra wealthy, in order to pay for some of the mess that they benefited from. And the Republicans are saying, no, can't do it. So they go, all of a sudden, you know, people are saying, well, they're not doing real well with that position. In other words, people are saying, wait a minute, the Republicans aren't don't want to tax the millionaires. Could it be that they're actually their, you know, stooges?
Yeah.
But now the Democrats actually want to continue a tax cut for the ordinary working person. And the Republicans want to raise the taxes. So, and get this, they always want to decrease the taxes on the millionaires, and they want to raise the taxes on the ordinary working people. And this is, they want to prevent, the Democrats do, President Obama, increase in Social Security payroll taxes that's going to occur in January. But the Republicans have been blocking this because they say that it will, it'll hurt the budget.
As with everything else.
Yeah. Let's see. But the Senate Republican leaders introduced a bill that would keep payroll tax rates at its current level for another year, which is what President Obama wants. The cost is roughly $120 billion, but Senate Republicans would offset most of the cost by freezing the pay of federal employees through 2015. And you might say, okay, you know, we've got some problems, so we don't want to, have pay raise, and gradually reducing the federal workforce by 10%. So they're going to create more unemployment by doing this.
Without a care.
Yeah. And how about this? But you figure the Senate Republican leaders would go after millionaires and billionaires, not by raising their taxes. Oh, no. But by making them ineligible for unemployment compensation and food stamps.
Oh, my gosh.
So you millionaires, we're not going to let you collect food stamps. This is insane.
It really is. Completely.
Yeah. Yeah. This is. And there's a couple of other things as well. Here's what's going on. There's this story. It says public sector sheds jobs. Blacks are hit hardest. African Americans who, it's a case of one particular bus driver in Chicago, Don Buckley. And he said, Mr. Buckley is one of tens of thousands of once solidly middle-class African-American government workers, bus drivers in Chicago, police and firefighters in Cleveland, nurses and doctors in Florida, who have been laid off since the recession ended in 2009. Such job losses have blunted gains made in employment and wealth during the previous decade and undermined the stability of neighborhoods where there are now fewer black professionals who own homes or who get up every morning to go to work. And I could imagine some white people think, whew, all right, it's them that lost their job, not us.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the us and them thing is what is really destructive. But through the recession and continuing economic downturn that have been devastating to the American middle class as a whole, the 2.5 years since the declared end of the recession has been singularly harmful, pardon me, to middle class blacks in terms of layoffs and unemployment. About 1 in 5 black workers have public sector jobs, and African-American workers are one-third more likely than white ones to be employed in the public sector. And to the extent that the right wing has demonized public workers, people are going, yeah, good, good. But, you know, we're talking about everything, police, fire, bus drivers, everything, postal workers, everything under the sun. And Robert Ziegler, history professor at the University of Florida, said the reliance on these jobs has provided African Americans a path upward, but it is also a vulnerability. So here's the deal. The so-called vaunted free market private sector has been unable to provide jobs for everyone. So racial discrimination, racism as a system, acted as a way to justify excluding a sector of the population right from the beginning.
Yeah.
It's how our jobs allocated. Well, a while ago, it was white men, period. And then, and there was everything under the sun, including a campaign 120 years ago up till, not so long ago,
right.
that domestic terrorism was used to keep this arrangement of white males intact in place. Yeah, so that lynchings and prison system and what have you was used to maintain a white only employment sector of jobs that could actually provide as it says, a path upward. And so the federal government actually stepped in and could provide these jobs at the same time having them that would provide good stuff for the community. But the Republicans are after this big time. So the other thing is, and just one other thing, and I'll get to your calls. See, somebody else wants to talk. Well, you know, actually, somebody's calling from South Carolina. Let me get this on.
Yeah, let's do it.
This is Michael calling all the way from South Carolina. Hi, Michael. Thanks for calling us way up here in Detroit. You're on the air.
Hey, guys, Jolene and Peter.
Hi.
Thanks for the Mike Malloy clip.
Okay.
Always love that.
He's always good.
Always.
He's a maniac. I love him.
But as a lead-in to your interview tonight, Peter, I actually worked for a professional Negro League baseball player.
Really?
Really?
Being a guy who was retired.
He didn't retire, but he played in the league, and he met his wife. She was a baseball groupie.
Huh.
You know of him, but you would never imagine it.
Who?
Can you say his name, or do you don't want to?
He sang country music.
Oh,
Charlie Pride?
Charlie Pride.
Exactly. Bingo.
Really?
Yes.
He was a ball player?
He was a professional baseball player.
Oh.
My dad loves himself some Charlie Pride.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I worked for him for 2 years.
Oh, I was going to say, give me his autograph for my daddy.
Oh, better than that. I actually have a baseball signed by Herman Kilbrew.
Okay.
I thought you were going to say Herman Cain.
I kind of slipped there. Yeah, Herman Kilbrew. I escorted him backstage and kind of took care of him for a day while he was visiting. Had no idea who the hell the man was. He was only the number four home run hitter.
Sure. Well, back to the Negro Leagues, though. There's a museum, a Negro League, National Negro League Museum in Kansas City, and for a while in Ferndale on 9 Mile Road. I never saw it. There was a store that sold sort of memorabilia paraphernalia.
Oh, cool.
And I don't know why I've had the interest in it, but now it's one of those things, you know, I have a mouse pad from the museum.
That's cool stuff.
Yeah. I actually had a Detroit Stars, this was the Detroit Negro League team, hat, and I lost it in Cuba. Whoa.
No.
There's a story.
Oh, man.
Actually, I lost my whole bag. My whole bag did not make it from Toronto to Havana, or to Holguin, I guess we flew in.
Them foreigners, man.
Yeah. Well, somebody in the Caribbean is wearing it, you can be sure. But the stories, I don't know, you can either through the podcast or if you're going to be up at 1:30. Listen to.
I'll be listening. Yeah.
Well, at 1:30.
Great show, by the way.
Okay. Well, I appreciate
that.
But at 1:30, there's the story of Satchel Paige, a guy who wrote a biography of him. Absolutely fascinating. This guy was throwing 100-mile-an-hour fastballs. 50 years ago, 60, no more than that, 70 years ago. One of the things, let me just tell you, because I read the book, I don't know if it's on the interview, it's a repeat show, that one of the things that would happen is that Satchel Paige, and I can't remember for the life of me now what his team was, but he would get the bases loaded with no outs, and then he would turn around to his other players, the other eight players, and he'd motion for them all to sit down. So the bases loaded, no outs, and he would motion them all to sit down so every player on his team would be sitting on the grass or on the infield. And then he would throw like 9 strikes and strike out the entire other team.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah.
Talk about smoking them.
Yeah.
Hardcore.
All right, Michael.
That's incredible.
Thank you for listening in South Carolina. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael.
Hey, you guys, keep it up. Keep up the good work.
Always.
We will. And then you keep listening.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Here is Bill in South Lyon. Hey, Bill, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great.
Yeah, I was calling in about that. When you're talking about the economy, it seems like all the rich millionaires and everybody keep getting richer, and the middle class is disappearing because they're just keeping all the money. The one way they could fix that was the pay the lottery. say it's like $150 million, instead of having one winner and the person keeping all the money and everything, they could have maybe every million have a winner, or every couple million have two winners. And it stimulates the economy. People start buying cars, people will start buying houses, and the economy will go up because it'll get stimulated.
Well, in that, you know, there's lots of little fixes, and that's not a bad idea in itself, Bill. But, you know, you could.
I think it's very creative.
Yeah. You could, one of the, here's what you really have to have. You got to have really massive taxation on, the ultra wealthy and the corporations. A lot of these corporations, as you probably know, paying no taxes whatsoever. And they have, probably more lawyers than the IRS, like a General Electric that paid no taxes.
No taxes.
Yeah. And, so you gotta have heavy taxation of the wealthy. And they would still, if you say, well, people should be rewarded for, what we tradition, in a manner we traditionally have rewarded people. But people don't need, $5 million, $50 million, $125 million a year income when other people can't even make ends meet, and when cities can't turn on their streetlights, like Highland Park,
right, exactly.
And you know, Detroit can't get the buses going.
And while one in five children are going to bed hungry in this country, that is completely shameful.
Yeah, I was trying to find something. I know what it was. It was about art that there's. You know, people are buying paintings for
millions and millions,
millions and millions and millions of dollars. You know. All right, Bill. Thanks. Let's keep on thinking creatively.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for calling the show.
The other thing I want to talk about is organizations representing more than 1.5 million Michigan people getting pensions and other seniors demanded on Friday that the Michigan legislature repeal the tax on pensions that is set to take effect on January 1st. You could say, well, you know, we all got to sacrifice. We all got to tighten our belt a little. Well, the rich aren't, but everybody that's getting a pension is now going to be taxed more. And here is why the Republicans in the Michigan legislature and Governor Snyder signed this. The tax was passed by the Republican legislature this summer and signed by Snyder as part of what they call a tax reform package to help finance, you ready for this? A $1.8 billion business tax cut.
That's okay.
Now, you want to, you know, the argument could be made that, this would help businesses would employ people and all that. But in the meantime, why in the world would you try to take this away from grandma and grandpa?
Yeah, exactly. That is just cruel.
People that have worked their ass off in an auto plant, and if you haven't worked in an auto plant, which I have not, but know enough people have and heard the stories and heard them from you over the years, that suddenly they would take a hit. They're not making much to begin with.
Yeah, they're already taking a hit.
Yeah, yeah. And fortunately, though, two-thirds of Michigan voters oppose this tax. I mean, and we got to pull the rug out from under these
guys.
Absolutely. Here's Josh in Garden City. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
We're doing good.
Hi, Josh.
Well, I'm one of the pierced, tattooed, I don't know, heathens, I guess you'd call them.
Yeah.
I'm with you. Me and my wife, we practice yoga. I've read the Harry Potter books, and I do acupuncture. I'm going to hell.
You are already in hell.
Yeah. You know what, Josh? You know what Mark Twain said: heaven for the climate, hell for the company.
Right.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Wait. Before you go on, where are your tattoos visible? If I meet you, or am I going to see them?
Oh yeah, I'm sleeved down to both my knuckles on my arm. My whole back's covered, most of my chest, my legs up to my kneecaps, my ankles.
You know, that's funny. You know, because things have changed so much. 100 years ago, they would have, I hate to say this, don't get me wrong, they would have you in a freak show as the tattooed man.
See, but now we are normal now.
Now you're normal.
Yeah.
Bank presidents have tattoos.
That's right.
Well, that depends. I mean, I'm a union millwright. Okay. I've been doing it for a long time. And the white collar engineers come out, and oh yeah, you're either a curiosity item to that, or you're one of those people that they don't want to talk to.
I just find that so disturbing.
You know increasingly, it. Though.
Nothing to do with the person.
That tattoos, I mean, you've got a considerable number, but mostly if you see a little tattoo, I mean, I see people at, salespeople here at work that have, not real big ones, not on their neck or anything, but on their ankle or something like that. You know, that, and as I said, I don't know if you heard me say earlier that I had a young friend who's got these visible tattoos. So he says he never wants to be in mainstream work. And I said, man, you know, bank presidents will have them pretty soon.
You're not such a rebel.
What is mainstream, though?
Well, that is true. That does not exist anymore.
It's like we always said, what's normal?
Yeah.
It's just, same kind of thing. What defines normal?
All right, Josh, I'm going to get the last call. Thanks for your story. Appreciate it. Stay normal. Here's Vince in Livonia. Hey, Vince, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, wait, you got to click that little...
What? Oh, I didn't do it?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, Vince. No, Vince.
There you go.
Vince, there. Hi, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I want to start out by prefacing, you guys were talking about taxes and stuff tonight. I wanted to start out by prefacing this by saying I'm totally a supporter of the Occupy Wall Street.
Okay.
I love the fact that there's this mass group of people that are getting together to, you know, stand up against major corporations. At the same time, I have to question the fact that, you've got all these protests going on across the country, and that, now it's starting to cost taxpayers money because of all the police forces and the medical needs that are going on. So my concern is the fact that you've got all this stuff that you got to take care of the people somehow.
Well, let me tell you this, Vince. The New York Police Department has spent, I forgot how many millions. The Oakland, California cops have spent millions. The Detroit cops have spent around zero. You know why? Because they said, you want to do this for a while, we'll work with you.
And you know what? In my opinion, people should be a lot more PO'd about where their tax dollars are going when it comes to war and bailouts and things like that. Not worried about this because this is a social movement that is actually creating a worldwide attention. And
the other thing is the money comes from these militarized police forces that wade into unarmed citizens that are dressed in, casual clothing with body armor, stun grenades, flash grenades, tear gas, pepper spray. They have helmets, 3-foot riot staves, and all of this. This is absolutely inappropriate and
unnecessary.
Yeah, yeah. I always quote Napoleon, who says the only thing you can't do with bayonets is sit on them. So in other words, if you have all that equipment, you don't want to just leave it in some warehouse. So the mayor says, all right, move them out. And then the police chief says to the commanders, all right, you got to move them out. And there's no reason, even if people were going to, as they've been doing, nonviolently resist sometimes by, holding, interlocking their arms. That's why that Lieutenant John Pike pepper sprayed those people, because they had the audacity to, kids, college
students. Now he's pepper sprayed the world.
Now he's pepper sprayed.
Even famous pieces of art.
Yeah. you're making me. That they could have easily gone in there it was out in California in shirt sleeves. Instead, they suit up. And part of it is propaganda on the part of the city, because when you show battle-ready police that look like soldiers, the word is these are dangerous people. The ideas are irrelevant. What's important here is these are people that are dangerous to us all, and you can tell by the way we have to dress. Ultimately, it's a political decision, though, because a mayor, a council could say, look, I don't want us to repeat what happened in New York, what happened in Oakland, what happened in a couple of other places. We're not bringing rifles down. And those, the pepper spray cop is the one that was famous. What should really be infamous is the other Davis police who actually brought high-powered assault rifles to wield against these unarmed students. Hey, we're out of time. Sorry. Give me an answer next week or
something.
Thank
you for calling.
Thank you, Vince.
Thanks to Sarah and Athena, and we'll have a podcast up tomorrow at noon. I'm doing this for you tonight.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. And stay tuned. A couple of great interviews next.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. When it's raining hard outside, can your roof still keep out the leaks inside? If it's time for a new roof, get your roofing installed the right way with Sears. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. You can save $500 if you call right now. Sears licensed fully insured contractors can get your roofing job done right. Sears has a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance, and you'll save $500 if you call now. So, for roofing done right, call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. That's Sears Roofing. Call right now and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
Listen up, ladies. Right now, Bare Minerals by Bare Essentials is inviting you to participate in a special nationwide giveaway of the mineral makeup everyone's talking about. That's right. We're letting everyone who calls try America's number one mineral makeup risk-free. Just call 1-800-506-8947 to find out how. This is an exclusive radio-only offer you don't want to miss. You've probably heard about Bare Minerals Foundation. It was quoted in Glamour Magazine as a magic eraser. Allure Magazine, InStyle, and Elle Magazines, and Leaders in Beauty continue to rave about how Bare Minerals Foundation is naturally radiant and good for your skin. Now you can participate in our nationwide giveaway and see for yourself. Bare Minerals, makeup so pure you can sleep in it. Experience the foundation that started the makeup revolution. Participate in this special opportunity to try Bare Minerals Foundation risk-free. We will also send you a free gift set. Just call 1-800-506-8947 now. Hurry, you don't want to miss this exclusive radio offer. 1-800-506-8947.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Detroit, the city we live in, for better or for worse, and it's always kind of a debate. Detroiters have this great sense of pride about the city we live in. I mentioned Detroit, in, you know, like in a movie, the house, and everybody goes, yeah, Detroit. And then, of course, all the downside of what's happened to us, how we've really gotten our butt kicked over globalism and corruption and what have you. Well, Detroit has always been a piece of work, always, right from its beginning. And a writer who I've interviewed before who just does absolutely terrific work is Richard Bach. It's B-A-K, Richard Bach. And he, in fact, I was just looking at a book. I remember somebody gave it to me, and I've never read it yet. And that is Turkey Stearns and the Detroit Stars, the Negro Leagues in Detroit. That was the Negro League baseball team here in the Motor City. I think they had a stadium out on Mack Avenue. And seeing this brand new book by Richard Bach made me want to pick that one up as well. It's a collection of a lot of his essays that have appeared in different magazines and other places, and including Our Detroit and just fumbling here for where they all were. Our Detroit, Detroit Monthly, Michigan History, the Sunday Magazine section of the Detroit News. And I never give presents. You know, I always just contribute to some good cause and tell people, hey, I donated to this or that group in your name. But this is a book I would give to people. It's called Detroit Land, a collection of movers, shakers, lost souls, and history makers from Detroit's past. It's a pleasure to welcome back Richard Bach. Hi, Richard.
Hello there, Peter. How you doing?
Forward by Neil Rubin as well. The Detroiters, and how about you? You're a lifelong Detroiter. Have sort of a love-hate relationship with the city?
Yeah. I you're not a true Detroiter unless you're torn between the two extremes. You like the city so much. You remember, you have fond memories of certain aspects of the city, but then on the other hand, it aggravates you when you see, the problems it's had over the years. But, I'm an optimist. maybe some people wouldn't say that, but I am optimistic. I have to be as a freelancer, and you have to think that tomorrow's going to be a better day. I think Detroit's moving slowly but surely towards that better day, but, you know, we'll see.
There's an old saying. I don't know where I ever heard it, but it was saying, I was born in Detroit, I'll die in Detroit, but I'm not going to live in Detroit. And I say I'm all three. I'm ready for all three. I've done two of them so far.
You wait too. For the third.
All right. What, the collection of movers, shakers, lost souls, and history makers from Detroit's past, Detroit land. How did you select these? I mean, you've just done, hundreds of articles. How did this?
Yeah, particular... yeah. Well, I mean, this is it's a collection of history pieces that I've written over the years, and I guess a lot of people around town know me as, that history guy. But, you know, I, like most journalists, I mean, I've been in the business for 30 years, and I've written about a wide array of subjects. But history's, a particular interest of mine, and especially local history. So this book puts together almost 30 of my favorite features that I've done for, as you mentioned, Our Detroit, Detroit Monthly, and so forth. And it covers almost a century of Detroit history from roughly the 1880s through the 1960s. All sorts of topics, all sorts of people that you may have heard the name before, but you really don't know that much about that person, or you think you maybe know the story, but the story turns out not to be exactly the way you thought it was. And then a lot of people that you just never heard of before. And I'll give you some examples.
I was going to say, how about Charles Lindbergh?
Well, we've all heard of Charles Lindbergh, right. Of course. But a lot of people don't know that he was born in Detroit, right around the Wayne State area. In fact, the house that he was born in was torn down in about 1974, just about the time he died. His family, most of his family is buried right here in the Detroit area. His mother was a chemistry teacher at Cass Tech at the time that he became the first person to fly from New York to Paris. And his uncle was John C. Lodge. Lodge Freeway's named after him. And at the time, John C. Lodge was the acting mayor of Detroit when Lindbergh crossed the ocean. Of course, Lodge never learned how to drive a car, but that's...
Really?
I find that fascinating. The freeway is named after a man who never bothered to learn how to drive it. In fact, he hated cars. But that's beside the point. But anyway, Lindbergh, yeah, so Lindbergh has this great deep history with Detroit. He came to Detroit in the 1940s during World War II to work at Willow Run with Henry Ford and so forth. In fact, there's a very good case could be made that had he gotten some backing from his uncle John, C. Lodge and some other people in Detroit at the time, the Spirit of St. Louis may very well have been called the Spirit of Detroit. He may have put Detroit on the map as an aviation center instead of, elsewhere. But in any event, he's a famous name. Maybe people don't realize that he's a Detroiter and he has this deep connection to Detroit. But there are other people that are just like Ben Turpin.
I was just going to mention, let me just say that the house, the Lindbergh house, I believe was on West Forest. Am I correct?
And yeah, 258.
258 West Forest. And yeah, back in the day, we would go by, there was a plaque there, then they tore it all down and put up something called Freedom Plaza or something
It was actually a rooming house. It might even been a frat house for Wayne State at one point, but they tore it down in the 70s.
Well, Ben Turpin, that was actually, what they say about great minds. Richard Bakke, by the way, is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Detroit Land, a collection of movers, shakers, lost souls, and history makers from Detroit's past is a collection of 30 of his essays. It's a painted turtle book put out by Wayne State University Press. Well, Ben Turpin, people are going, wait a minute, wasn't that a silent film star?
Yeah. Well, this gentleman's name was actually Henderson Turpin, he got the nickname Ben because of, as you mentioned, the silent film actor. But Ben Turpin was he came up from Alabama in the 1920s, part of the Great Black Migration from that period. Came up to Detroit, worked as a shoeshine boy at the train station, and ultimately was hired into the Detroit Police Department at a time when there were very few black patrolmen. Ben Turpin was hired for one reason, according to somebody that I interviewed, one of his contemporaries, and that was to kick butt. People weren't worrying about Miranda rights and things like that back in the 1920s. They were just trying to keep the peace. And Ben Turpin was a patrolman who gained a measure of fame or infamy patrolling Black Bottom, which was the black neighborhood Detroit back then on the Lower East Side.
But tell people why it's called Black Bottom. Didn't have anything to do with the population.
No. Actually, because it was very rich soil. Oh. You know, a couple centuries earlier when the French were settling the area, and it was actually called Black Bottom long before the first African Americans were living there. But you know, at any rate, so Henderson or Ben Turpin wound up, administering his own. Oh, type of singular justice to the denizens of Black Bottom, and some crazy stories about the guy. But he was rumored to kill as many as 20 people, crooks and schnooks, including one member of the Purple Gang, which was documented. He had run-ins with Coleman Young's father, who was a bit of firebrand back then. I've got some stories in there about the interactions between Ben Turpin and Coleman Young Sr. He also straightened out a young Joe Lewis. You know, Joe Lewis grew up on Catherine Street. He came up from Alabama in the 20s, his family, and Joe started hanging around with the wrong crowd. And, you know, Turpin kind of took him under his wing, made sure that, you know, he kept an eye out on this young guy and you know, didn't go down the wrong path. Fascinating character. He was loud, boisterous, profane, kind of hard-drinking guy. He walked around with two pearl-handled revolvers around his waist, his considerable waist. In fact, he coached a team in Black Bottom called Turpin's Athletic Club. It was a baseball team. And he coached this team, took them on road trips, and he was also the catcher on the team. And as I write in the book, I suspect most close calls on the diamond went his way because he wore his revolvers when he was catching, or he twirled them away in his catcher's equipment, you know. So, he was a real character. I mean, you know, I don't want to give away a bunch of stuff about, you know, a lot of these people I'm talking about because I want them to buy the book, of course, and find out more. But, some great stories about him. I got them from his files. I got the stuff from the files. This would have been about 15, 20 years ago. I don't even know if that stuff exists anymore, but, I was able to get it through a connection at the police department.
Well, I've read some of these essays before in some of the magazines in which they originally appeared, but when I hear you describing these, it only makes me, so don't worry about giving away too much, when I hear you describing it, it only makes me want to read or reread them. In fact, in reading them, I mean, it's interesting history, and it's good writing, and it has a great flow to it, and almost to the point it sounds like, quote, natural, where, I mean, I'm not talking about the writing ability, but the just everything that makes up the story. Yeah, this must take a tremendous amount of work and research to put all of this together.
Well, number one, I'll say that all the stories, yes, they appeared, you know, as you mentioned previously, but they've all been updated. A lot of them have been expanded. Some of those chapters are twice as long as they originally appeared in the magazines. I was given a lot more space, you know, with a book than I was in a magazine. So, straight jacket, you might have to write 2,500 words, and that's all you get. But, you know, with a book, you can double it to 5,000 words and really get into the subject. But getting back to your question about the research, well, you know, every story is different. Some stuff just kind of falls into your lap, and you might have a single source, and you get a ton of material. On the other hand, you might run into somebody who says, oh, yeah, you know, I know this guy, and then you talk to them, and then he knows somebody, and so you wind up talking to a half dozen people. And then in other cases, I mean, there's nobody to talk to. You know, nobody's alive. You know, it's so far in the past that, you know, you can only go through microfilm and you know, and whatever is available in books and so forth.
Well, when you're researching something, I mean, obviously you have an idea. You have to have a subject, and then you go out after it and you start writing about it. You start doing research. And do you wind up being as surprised as a reader might to see what is in your stories or see, you know, the basis for what you write?
Well, you know, it's like historians always call it the thrill of a fact. You know, you're out there stumbling and bumbling around or doing a lot of reading or just talking with a lot of people. And then you come across something that just makes, you know, makes the whole story. And and I think that happens with a lot of journalists and historians and writers in general. It's just, you know, you got to keep plugging away and talking to other people. And another thing too is that, you know, there's really no correlation between the amount of time and effort or even money that you spend on one certain avenue of research and what you get from that research. You might get everything you need, you know, in one trip to the library, you know, and just going through some, you know, some files at the Burton Historical Collection or, you know, or going through microfilm for an afternoon. On the other hand, you might spend 4 hours talking to somebody who was a relative of the principal character in your story, and you go away saying, you know, I didn't get anything from that. You know, we talked about the weather for 4 hours, essentially. So, you know, you just never know what you're going to find. And, you know, that's the deeper you dig, you know, and the deeper you go, the more good stuff you can come up with. This book's kind of different, obviously, from other books I've done because it's sliced into 27 chapters, and the chapters, the only unifying element is the fact that they're all stories about old Detroit. But if you're doing a book on just a single subject, you know, that requires obviously much more research, much more time, you know, because you're just working on a single subject.
Sure. Actually, I said there were 30 stories in here. I think I was taking that from the number of books you've written, which is in that area. My guest is Richard Bach. It's B-A-K. And Richard told me before the program, he's like everybody else in the process of setting up a website. In the meantime, if you just Google, as I did, Richard Bach, B-A-K, there's a lot of information out there, a lot of ways you can order the book. They're perfect gifts, by the way. This is absolutely terrific book. It's called Detroit Land, a collection of movers, shakers, lost souls, and history makers from Detroit's past. It has a foreword by Neil Rubin of the Detroit News. It's a painted turtle book from Wayne State University Press. Now, one of the things that struck me, I mean, I knew this story, and I remember reading this, was this in Our Detroit about the Black Legion? Where did that first?
Oh, yeah, the Black Legion. Yeah, that appeared in Our. I would say the majority of these first appeared in Our.
Okay. Well, one of the things that's kind of shocking about this, and I'll let Richard tell you why, you know, the shocking details of it. The late 1930s was thought of as the heyday of progressive and liberal politics, of labor unions, of the idea that that organizing for everything from social justice, but racial justice, economic justice, was almost accepted by everyone. And there were, when you think of like the Ku Klux Klan, you're thinking Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. The Black Legion, and I'd ask Richard to give just sort of a thumbnail sketch of this, was operating in Detroit, even wound up in the movies. But Richard, take it away.
Well, I mean, the Black Legion is kind of like the localized version of the KKK. I mean, it was a white supremacist group that, you know, came to light in the as you mentioned, in the 1930s because of a killing that occurred actually not far from my house. Where Dearborn Heights is right now, that area was on a farm over there that a malcontent was murdered, and that kind of, you read the chapter in the book, it'll describe how the whole Black Legion just came crumbling down during the summer of 1936. But for many years prior to that, the Legion had been operating, again, in the Midwest, mostly in Michigan and Ohio, but also Illinois and Indiana. You know, they were, they had infiltrated, the unions. They were basically a secret lodge, and for many of the members, and to this day, nobody really knows how many members there were. I estimate there were about 80,000 to 100,000.
Whoa.
Yeah, well, I mean, the newspapers, though, really played it up, and they had them, like, you know, as this threat to the nation. There were like 5 or 6 million members, and that's not true, and I go into that in pretty good detail. But they hated everybody, basically. I mean, you know, they hated everybody. They hated blacks. They hated immigrants. They hated Catholics. You know, they probably hated their grandmother, too. I don't know. They hated everybody. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, Malcolm X, obviously, the famous civil rights firebrand from the 60s, Malcolm X, who grew up in Lansing, he grew up as Malcolm Little. His father was probably killed by the Black Legion. In 1931, Malcolm Little's father, Earl Little, was run over by a streetcar in Lansing. And he was an outspoken preacher, and local authorities thought that, you know, it was an accident or more improbably a suicide. I don't know how you get commit suicide by getting run over by a streetcar. But in any event, you know, Malcolm X grew up believing that it had actually been an execution, that, you know, it was a message delivered by the Black Legion to intimidate, you know, what they considered to be uppity blacks, quote unquote.
This is interesting because Detroit, and you mentioned immigrants and Catholics, is the East Side was heavily immigrant and Catholic, and the West Side was much more Protestant, and a lot of Southerners coming up. And that's where the Klan and the Black Legion, and I'm just saying this off the top of my head, you correct me if I'm wrong, had its strength, because I know the Klan during the 1920s was very big on the west side of Detroit. They have I forgot now how to say his name, Ocean Sweet.
Ocean Sweet.
Well, you know, I've heard seen it both ways, Ossian or Ocean. But anyway, that was a famous case where a black MD or had shot into a mob in his house, and a famous case with Clarence Darrow and all that. But there was this this split, wasn't there, between whites actually in Detroit?
In terms of
I would say the East Side being immigrant and Catholic, the West Side being more native born and Protestant. And that,
absolutely, yeah. No, you're right. In fact, you know, just veering off topic a little bit, it was interesting to discover that even among blacks there was a big split in the early part of the 20th century, because a lot of the old line blacks that lived in Detroit did not get along at all with the Southern immigrants that came up, you know, during the First World War and after that. You would think they would all get along together, but they didn't. So anyway.
Yeah. Well, actually, I worked for the city of Detroit, helping to relocate families when they were putting in the Chrysler Freeway. So that goes back. I was very, very, very young. Yeah. And that the neighborhoods, the African American neighborhoods on the East Side, were very cohesive and coherent, and you know, around their churches, their neighborhood groups, burial societies, everything like that. When you get over to the West Side, 12th Street and what have you, that's when you started to have the crumbling of the social bonds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those freeways were absolutely devastating to the black community.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, to the entire city at large, I think. Right.
Well, we talk about straying from the book Detroit Land by Richard Bach. And by the way, I just wanted to tell people, if you want to write me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, because I may say Richard Bach's name 20 times during this interview, and a lot of you are like driving and you'll miss it. So if you can remember that, email me or any comments, and I'll be glad to respond to you. So there's tons of stories in here. Maybe, I don't know, I've always been such a big fan of the Detroit Stars. I have a Detroit Stars cap, even.
Well,
I mean, not an original, of
sure,
course. But that was the Negro League, and those were, was I right? Did they have a stadium out on Mack Avenue?
Yeah. There was by Southeastern High School.
Yeah.
It was built, I believe it opened in 1908 or 1910 by John Rosenzweig, who was a local haberdasher. And he brought in various teams to, you know, as an attraction. And one of them was the Detroit Stars, which started off as a semi-pro team, you know, sometime around the period of World War One. And when the Negro National League was formed in Kansas City in 1920, it became a professional professional team, and played at Mack Park until the park burned down in 1929. Well, it didn't burn down. Parts of it burned. And then he moved to Hamtramck, to a stadium in Hamtramck. But, yeah, the Stars were, they were a going concern. A team filled, really, with stars, good players. Several of these players could have played in the major leagues, in my mind. First baseman Edgar Wesley, catcher Bruce Petway, certainly Turkey Stearns, who was elected to the Hall of Fame the same year that Sparky Anderson was inducted. Mule Riggins at shortstop, just some great players. In fact, what's his name? Bill Holland, pitcher, and Andy Cooper, another one. He made his career in the Negro Leagues, basically with the Detroit Stars, and he was elected to the Hall of Fame a couple years ago.
You know, I made the suggestion to an African American friend of mine who's kind of an entrepreneur, and I said, "What do you think about resurrecting the Negro League for Tiger Stadium?" This was before they tore it down.
Yeah.
He kind of looked at me and said, "Let me get back to you on that."
You know, it's funny. I just I'm doing a piece. Next April will be 100 years since Tiger Stadium, which at the time was known as Navin Field, was opened. That was 1912. So there'll be some sort of, you know, there'll be some sort of local, you know, events tied in with that, even though the stadium's no longer there. But, you know, a lot of people forget that or don't know that prior to 1912, when Tiger Stadium was built, or the grandfather Tiger Stadium, which was, you know, Navin Field, the Tigers had played 16 years on that same spot at an old rickety wooden ballpark named Bennett Park.
Sure.
That's where Ty Cobb and so forth played. But I just found out the other day when I was doing some research that Negro League teams had played at Bennett Park as early as 1908. There was an actual, well, they always called them World Championship Series. That was a way to attract people in. But there was a so-called Colored World Championship Series played at Bennett Park in 1908 between the Philadelphia Colored Giants and the Chicago Colored Giants. And I don't think they drew many. I was trying to find out, you know, trying to read between the lines to see how many people actually attended this three-game series. It seemed like there were no more than maybe 500 or 600 a game. But it was very fascinating to me to find out that, you know, I mean, there were some great ballplayers playing on that field, including Rube Foster, who was the founder of the Negro National League in 1920.
Well, I always thought it was a shame that they didn't continue at Tiger Stadium till at least the year 2000, because it would have been the only baseball stadium in history that ever had play on it in three separate centuries.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they should have kept the damn thing up. I mean, you know, if nothing else, I mean, just looking at it from a business point of view, if that's the way, you know, you want to look at it instead of just purely nostalgia, you know, when you have some poor drawing team coming to town to Detroit to play in the middle of August and the Tigers, especially the first several years at Comerica Park, where that team was just dreadful, they could have really pumped the gate by saying, you know, let's play a 3 or 4 game series at Tiger Stadium.
Huh.
You know, and, you know, I mean, you could have packed that stadium. You could have made it a special event.
Wow. Did you put forth that idea?
Well, you know, Mike Ellis doesn't return my call. So, but no, I mean, you know, to me it seemed natural. Now, of course, it's easy for me to say because I'm not the one who has to provide parking and upkeep and security for a stadium the other 300 days of the year where you're not using what is in effect a second stadium.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I mean, you know, the Packers played in two different stadiums.
Sure.
for many years. You know, they would play, you know, in Green Bay, but they also scheduled occasional games in Milwaukee, you know, because they could draw more people there and, you know, and appeal to a crowd that normally wouldn't have a chance or wouldn't have a reason to go see the Packers.
Sure. Well, hey, I got bad news and good news. The bad news is our conversation, I see by the clock, is over. The good news for the listeners is that Detroit Land, a collection of movers, shakers, lost souls, and history makers from Detroit's past, a collection of 27 expanded essays by Richard Bach, B-A-K, is available. It's a Painted Turtle book. It's available from Wayne State University Press. I will have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And if you have any communication about this show, you want to find out how to get a hold of Richard Bach, his books or whatever, you can write me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Richard Bach, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
How do you get the most satisfaction? For some career-minded people, it's when they work toward a goal and reach it. The same may apply to you when preparing for your career. In fields like electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design, you need knowledge and skills to get started. That's why you should call ITT Technical Institute. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Call 800-741-5123. ITT Tech's program programs are designed to help you develop skills and knowledge to pursue your career interest. Classes and day or evening courses meet just a few days a week, and financial aid's available for those who qualify. So pick up the phone right now and call ITT Tech for more information. Call 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123. For important information about these programs, go to programinfo.itt-tech.edu. Do you own a car you no longer want, and you don't have the time or energy to sell it? Donate your car to Heritage for the Blind. Your donation is tax deductible, and your car will be towed away for free. Call 1-800-943-1356. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, trucks, vans, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. Call now. Your donation will help those in need. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call now to donate your car, and as a special thank you, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to over 50 locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-943-1356. Donating is easy, it's tax deductible, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher by donating. Call 1-800-943-1356. 1-800-943-1356.
Our son would go from "Good morning, Mom," to words you'd never expect to come out of your child's mouth. Our pain came from not knowing what to do. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. 5 or 6 years later, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. I think the hardest part of living with someone who has a mental illness is thinking that you're alone, that no one else could understand. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is made up of people who live it every day. We lean on each other and we learn from each other. NAMI doesn't let anyone give up hope. My name is Mary Tadigan, and I can tell you what NAMI has meant for my family. It has meant that we are a family.
1 in 5 adults lives with depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, or other mental illnesses. NAMI provides education and support to these families and individuals. To find a local chapter, go to NAMI.org or call 800-950-NAMI.
Homeowners, how do you find the right contractor when you want something built? How do you find the best service professional when you need something fixed? For any type of service for your home, go to the most trusted website for pre-screened home pros. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource that instantly connects you with pre-screened remodelers, maids, repairmen, and many other home contractors. If you need a plumber, electrician, painter, or any other home pro, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free, and it's the smartest way to find neighbor-rated contractors in your area. Over 10 million homeowners have trusted Service Magic for their home improvement and maintenance projects. So hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, particularly some of you younger people listening, I got to tell you something. There was a time when there wasn't an internet, there wasn't a World Wide Web, and people communicated in different ways. I know you've heard about things called handwritten letters. And some of what we're going to talk about still remain, and those are newspapers, but feeling that those are going to be in the museum as well. But in every upsurge of what we call contestation, that is a radical upsurge of challenge to the status quo going back into the 18th century, even, but certainly when you hit the 1880s through to the 1960s, when protest movements began, they also created a vibrant newspaper culture. And these were ones that were put together by radicals, by unions, by feminists, by anti-war groups, by gay groups, you name it. There was a vibrant, what was called an underground press. The term, of course, comes from World War II and like a Nazi-occupied Europe. Well, the terrific book just came my way. It's called Smoking Typewriters, the 60s. That is in the 1960s. The 60s, Underground Press and the Rise of Alternative Media in America. Now, here in Detroit, we have the Metro Times, Real Detroit, a lot of other papers like this. But we're going to be talking specifically about the newspapers that were so prevalent during that tumultuous period of the 1960s. And joining me, the author, is John McMillan. He is assistant professor of history at Georgia State University. He's co-editor of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of an American radical tradition. Also, The New Left Revisited, Protest Nation, The Radical Roots of Modern America, and The 60s, a journal of history, politics, and culture. He lives in Athens, Georgia, but we're reaching him in Boston. John McMillan, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. I live in Atlanta, actually, just for a point of clarification.
Okay. Well, you know what? I must have been thinking of REM.
People get Georgia State and University.
Yeah, it says Atlanta right here. I read.
Yeah, it's all right.
I read Athens. No matter. Hey, I should. It seems like every time that I do an interview lately, I have to give a full disclosure statement. I should say that I am quoted in this book by John McMillan, Smoking Typewriters, and because of my work with a newspaper called The Fifth Estate, published here in Detroit for years and years, actually right now in its, let me see, do the math, 46th year of publication, longest running publication of that nature. Am I right on that? Is my history good enough?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. The Fifth Estate is, I guess, the only continuing underground newspaper from the 60s. I haven't kept up with it, and I understand it's changed a lot, but I guess you've been running continuously since 1965, was it?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So there's my full disclosure. So I'm very happy to see this book, and although our goal was to end history, we are now history. And John McMillan, so you, I'm looking at your photo, so you couldn't have been too old during that period of the 1960s. Tell us, what's the fascination here of, you know, every historian has to focus on some area. Why this?
Well, I was born in 1970, so I missed out on the 60s.
Okay.
I grew up in a small town in Michigan, and I had kind of like a layperson's interest in the culture of the era. I loved the Beatles at a very early age, and I knew who Abbie Hoffman was, you know, by the time I was in ninth grade, and no one else in my school did. And so Charles, as weird as it sounds, Charles Manson, I was, you know, interested in him. But I didn't know that it was going to be a vocation I didn't think it would be a scholarly pursuit until I got to graduate school. And I was planned on studying antebellum race relations, but I saw that there was a new generation of people, just a little bit older than myself, who were the first generation of people to write about the 60s without having participated in that, in those events. And so there was a kind of revisionist movement that was underway, and a lot of these people are my friends, and it suddenly dawned on me that this is what I could do.
It's interesting you use that phrase, revisionist history, because there's sort of a counter-revisionist history that says, contrary to what so many people have said, to essentially romanticize that period of protest and revolt, that it was actually very awful, and some people on the right say that you can draw a line between the challenges to American institutions and everything that's gone wrong since.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, Bill Clinton said something that I think was shrewd on this point once. He said, if you look back at if you look back at the 60s and you think that there was more harm done than good, then you're probably a conservative or a Republican. If you think that on balance there was more good than bad from the 60s, you're probably a liberal or a Democrat. And I think that, that seems to hold true. And in my experience, a lot of the, even in the last, presidential election, I was astonished to see the cultural politics of the 60s playing such a big role. And so, it's still fundamentally important.
John McMillan is my guest. Oxford University Press has published his Smoking Typewriters, the 60s Underground Press and the Rise of the Alternative Media in America. Give us a scope, and this is tough, isn't it, to really get a handle on how many newspapers there were and the circulation. We always floated a quite large figure. I'm going to let you go at it, and then I'll see if I'm exaggerating or not.
Well, it's hard to say precisely how many papers there were at any one time and what the circulation was, but, someone has, figured out that the underground press of the 60s does, in fact, represent one of the most aggressive and spontaneous growths in the history of publishing. And, with the Fifth Estate that you were involved with, I think you in 1965, I believe there were five papers.
Right.
And maybe six in 1966. And then by the end of, 1966 and 1967, in every campus and community across the country, papers started appearing. And by the end of the 60s, we had, 300 or 400 or 500 papers, with a combined circulation that stretched into the millions easily. And so it was a pretty spectacular growth.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. That's and I like it that you didn't actually put a figure on it. And I don't even know that it's important because they had an impact. That they, there was a Black Panther Party slogan mm-hmm. that said, I think Huey Newton said it, that power is the ability to define phenomena. Or if you could get rid of that word, you'd say power is the ability to define reality. And here in Detroit, I mean, did you read if there was a demonstration? Say against George Wallace, the Southern racist who ran for president in 1968. Did you read the Detroit News account of the demonstration there, which was called a riot, or did you read the Fifth Estate account that said that there was this police assault by these pro-Wallace white Detroit police officers who did incredible harm and damage and with intense brutality to the demonstrators? So it was essentially right. I mean. Whose reality is it?
Well, I mean, I think that the underground press writers were honest about their subjectivity and their bias. They didn't try to be neutral or fair or even-handed or whatnot. They acknowledged where they were coming from. But the thing that, that made them frustrated was that the mainstream press, the agenda-setting papers like the New York Times or the Washington Post, sort of refused to own up to their own bias as well. And they had a bias in favor of, I guess, what you would call mainstream or center values. But they claim this mantle of objectivity. And so you mentioned the George Wallace issue. I don't go into that particular episode, but there's lots of times in the book where I will compare the reports of, mainstream papers with the writing that was done by underground, radical journalists. And I do think there are quite a few times when the amateur radicals, outperform the salaried professional journalists. That did happen.
Well, if you were as a historian and you were looking at a particular incident and you saw conflicting accounts, would it depend on your particular point of view or the prejudice, as you said earlier, that one would come into it? So here you have the Detroit News account of something that happened in 1968, and you're looking at it in 2011, and here's the underground press, the Fifth Estate, that has an alternate view. How does one determine what was reality, forgetting about what is reality?
No, I mean, that's a great question. You just have to look at, a wider range of primary source material and use your instincts and training as a historian to figure out, what account is more likely to be more accurate. I begin the book by talking about a Rolling Stones concert at Altamont that was very infamous, and this is the show where the Hells Angels did security and a person died, and by every single account, people who were there remember it as a frightening experience. It was something that was it was a disaster for the counterculture. And if anyone has seen that the film Gimme Shelter, they know what I'm talking about. And the underground press,
the documentary,
it's a documentary, right? And the underground press sort of described it in these terms. But then if you look at the San Francisco Examiner, which is the flagship paper of the whole Hearst newspaper, enterprise, I mean, initially they described this concert with a kind of like Woodstock-style sentimentalism. They, specifically reported there was no violence. They botched their coverage. And then, later on realized it had been a disaster for the counterculture, but their tone was so priggish and excoriating that it's very hard to imagine any younger readers, taking them seriously. And they were just, the mainstream press was just incredibly dismissive of, the Rolling Stones, and why would anyone want to attend a concert with them? Because it was just very disparaging. And younger, underground journalists, not only, got the better sense of what happened there, but they also claimed for themselves a kind of epistemic privilege. It was an idea that by being deeply implicated in the rock and protest culture, you can better understand what's happening there. And then the mainstream journalists were just too far removed to sort of accurately represent their worldview.
The book is Smoking Typewriters, The 60s Underground Press and the Rise of Alternative Media in America by John McMillan. There's so many, you know, that's why people write books. Sometimes I think, how can I get this all in 25 minutes? And then I realize you can't. You got to go to the book. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, PeterWerbe.com. John's last name is M-C, capital M-I-L-L-I-A-N, and that's johnmcmillan.com. There'll be a link there as well. Give us an idea. You know, we've only talked about the Fifth Estate here in Detroit. There was also one of the first papers was a newspaper that simply called itself The Paper from East Lansing. But either the names themselves are interesting or people may have heard of some of the more prominent underground papers of the 1960s. What were they?
Well, the Los Angeles Free Press, sometimes nicknamed the Freep, is generally considered the first paper, and that was in 64. And then the Berkeley Barb was pretty famous and had these papers had substantial readerships, you know, in the hundreds of thousands, at their peak. The East Village Other was a big paper in New York. And, you know, that paper you mentioned that was simply called The Paper, that was the first campus underground newspaper, and it was kind of neat for me to write about because I went to Michigan State I was an undergraduate there, and I don't know where I'm going with this.
We were talking about other papers. What was in Atlanta where you live? There was the Great Speckled Bird. Yeah.
So
the Kaleidoscope in Milwaukee, uh-huh. The Seed in Chicago, mm-hmm. And is there a common thread, or do they each have a sort of a unique quality to them?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think it's a bit of both. I mean, you know, each paper, I think, was fundamentally, these are community newspapers, and so they were distinctive in the sense that they reflected what was happening in their communities, and they reflected the sensibilities of the people who ran them and, you know, put them together. But there were these organizations that you know about, called Liberation News Service and the Underground Press Syndicate, and they were ways, without going into a lot of detail, that the ways of nationalizing content. So if you were in the Fifth Estate, for instance, in Detroit, you probably didn't have a budget to send someone off to, you know, New York City to cover the uprising at Columbia when there was a big protest there. But a group like Liberation News Service could send out, you know, its reports to all the other underground papers. And then for a small fee, you probably got their articles, and then you could give, you know, you could provide news accounts of something that was happening very far away from Detroit. And so lots of underground papers were interconnected in that way.
Yeah, and also Liberation News Service being have its politics being leftist or new leftist, as they were called then, sent people to Vietnam and Cuba and Latin mm-hmm. America, Africa, a lot of reports from Europe. So there was essentially this, what was like the Associated Press, was able to provide sometimes twice weekly packets, including photographs as well. So the quality of many of the papers began to rival those of the mainstream press that were pretty dull affairs, both content and visually.
Mm-hmm.
And speak a little about the visual content as well. I think that's mm-hmm. pretty important.
I don't write about this as much in the book. My concerns are, or my interest is on how these underground papers sort of, you know, contributed to the growth and the cultural logic of the new left and the counterculture. But, you know, in the 60s, you saw the advent of photo offset printing. So basically whatever you wanted to put onto a backing sheet, whether it was, you know, newsprint or pictures or collages or anything else, you would take a picture of it and then it would be reproduced exactly the way it was set. And so, you know, and then also people experimented with what was called split fountain printing techniques. And you could get these beautiful kind of rainbow splash, you know, psychedelic flavored papers, you know, no two of which were ever 100% exactly alike. And a lot of the graphic, you know, design that we associate with the 60s came out of the underground press. There's also these underground comics, and a lot of people probably know Robert Crumb or whatnot. You know, a lot of these writers also emerged from the from underground papers.
And some of the artists that also did the concert posters, like Gary mm-hmm. Grimshaw and Carl Lundgren, who did back covers for the Fifth Estate with that psychedelic art quality. So there was this merging of sort of psychedelia and left radical politics. Was it always comfortable within the papers, or was there tension?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. I think historians always kind of have wanted to make a distinction between the, you know, the hippies who were sort of aesthetic in their radicalism and they were, you know, interested in dropping out, you know, and then the politicos who were the people who were trying to, you know, organize people and build support and make, you know, political reforms. And there are some papers that reflected those divisions. There are some papers that were heavy into, you know, LSD and being groovy, and some papers that were very left-wing militant. But most papers, I think, especially by the late 60s, sort of combined, they had some elements of both of these styles of radicalism. They were both cultural and political. And so I think that, you know, if you study the 60s through the prism of these papers, you get a better sense of the degree to which these two tendencies were intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
Other historians have suggested thus far.
Some nice photographs in John McMillan's Smoking Typewriters, the 60s underground press and the rise of alternative media in America. A shot of James Gurley, who was the guitarist for Big Brother and the Holding Company, Janis Joplin's group, reading the Ann Arbor Sun in 1968.
Yeah.
And then a picture of John Sinclair himself, handcuffed, giving the peace sign, one of the many times that he and the MC5 were arrested for their famous song, Kick Out the Jams, which began with this.
Which we can't say on the
even
air.
Today, we can at least, I don't know, we wouldn't get arrested. I would get fired and the station would lose its license, but that's all. John McMillan is my guest. Smoking Typewriters from the Oxford University Press is my guest. We're starting to run, we do have some time, but I want to connect this up with today's alternative press. Most of the, if my memory serves me, most of the underground press of the 1960s were sold. I mean, they weren't giveaways, or as they're called in the trade, sometimes throwaways. People had to pay for them. And they also set the style. And I wonder if you could talk about the influence that the underground press had on what we call the alternative weekly press today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the underground press, I mean, the people who ran these underground papers, you know, professed to have no interest in really making money. After these underground papers began to fade away, we saw a sort of second generation alternative press. And then these are the free papers that are distributed, you know, in vending boxes, you know, in cities, you know, all across the country. And these are commercially oriented, but still usually left wing and maybe muckraking in their approach. But they also present, you've got is it called the Metro Times in Detroit now?
Yes.
They have listings that tell you what's going on around campus. They were around the city rather, concerts and whatnot. They were very profitable for a while. I think they're losing a little bit of their, with the advent of Craigslist and social networking sites and dating websites and whatnot, they're having a rough time, just like lots of people in the print media. But they were appealing to this coveted, 18 to 34 demographic, and they had quite a run.
Well, today, if somebody wants to find out what's happening this coming weekend in Detroit, the whole Detroit area, of course, the colds have got us all, don't they? That you can go to the Metro Times, Real Detroit, any number of other papers. But you can also go to the mainstream papers, Detroit Free Press, Detroit News, and they'll have a very hip and splashy calendar. And none of them had calendars. They would announce Detroit Symphony Orchestra or that Lawrence Welk or somebody was coming to town. But when the underground press, like here in Detroit, when the Fifth Estate, they would have, you know, poetry readings, anti-war demonstrations, stuff like that. People said, wow, this is an underground culture that's only barely underground because it had a pretty widespread expression. So the underground press actually influenced the mainstream press as well, right?
Sure. I think you said it very well. I mean, they sort of stumbled on a formula that could be that could be commercialized, I suppose. And the alternative press, I'm a big fan. And I live in Atlanta. And, you know, the Creative Loafing is the paper that we have there. And as you suggest, it's the place that you can go to figure out what's going on around town.
You're not very hopeful about print media at all, are you?
I mean, the thing is, I love it. I mean, I read a daily newspaper. It's part of my news diet. And when I used to live in New York in the 90s, the New York Press was a paper that I used to rush out on Tuesday nights to get it from the vending boxes downtown because they didn't come to my uptown location until Wednesday morning. So I would get The Voice and the New York Press. I used to love these papers, but I think they're having a tough time economically. And there's been such an explosion of new voices that, you know, the barriers or gateways to journalism have been, you know, abolished. And so I do worry about, you know, the future of, you know, newspapers on newsprint. I'll be one of the last people to, you know, I'll keep buying them until, for as long as I have them, but I don't know how much longer we're going to have.
Well, they're, you know, it seems real 20th century to want to affirm printed newspapers when all of it is right there and you can keep clicking on the New York Times, nytimes.com, and you can get, like, every 20-minute updates. But
yeah,
this may be of interest to you. I'm going to give a workshop in Ann Arbor at an organizing conference on the value of print media in organizing efforts.
Okay.
And it seems counterintuitive because what's the good thing about having information that organizers might have for any particular campaign or political party or whatever? You can, the cost is pretty low. The cost is very high for newspapers. Newspapers are labor intensive. All this stuff. You got to distribute them. So you would think, wow, why don't we get rid of these babies and get electronic media? My argument is exactly the same, is that not when you have a newspaper and you're doing particularly organizing, you actually have to go around to people and say, hey, let's use the Fifth Estate as an example. You know, say you're going door to door in a community. You know, we've got a newspaper here. Here's about our campaign, like that. And then you need money for it. And
yeah,
people have to take money out of their pocket to subscribe or to make donations. It makes a commitment. And then you got to say, wow, we don't have enough to pay the print bill. Maybe we ought to get the MC5 or the 21st century version of it to play a benefit for us. And then that brings the community together. So, well, that's my whole argument. I don't know how I'm going to fill 45 minutes. But what do you think?
Well, good luck with that. I mean, the thing is just that I think a lot of people, you know, younger people don't find it so interesting to put, you know, images on ink on paper when there's so much they can do creatively, you know, in the electronic realm.
Yeah.
And that's just my sense. So, but if you can win some converts, you know, keep going. You've got a great run with the Fifth Estate. You know, I mean, not many papers last as long as that one. So.
It's in it, by the way. It's on, in fact, maybe people should wait because it's just about to launch a new website. It's fifthestate.org. And John McMillan has been my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book is a terrific account of the 60s underground press and the rise of the alternative media in America. It's, and it's a great scholarship. There's about almost 90 pages of footnotes, almost all of the footnotes, which are interesting as well. So, John, I want to thank you so much. I should say people can also click onto my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, and there will be a link to the book. And also you can go to John's website, John McMillan, that's McMillian.com. Thanks for being on the broadcast.
It's been a pleasure, and it's nice to speak with you. You know, I found some of your, you know, our material in various archives when I was doing research for this book. You know, letters that you've written to, you know, people that survived, and so it's nice to finally be in touch.
Yeah, at the beginning I gave this full disclosure. I should tell people that may have not caught it all, that I'm both quoted in the book and mentioned. So I particularly love it. And I think I wrote to you, John. I said, you're one of the few places that's ever quoted me accurately. So
I spelled your name right?
You did indeed.
Okay, so there you go.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Is it time for a new roof? Call Sears Roofing. You can save $500 if you call right now. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Get your roofing job done right. Call Sears Roofing now. You can save $500. Call now. 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
So we're back, and we got some more music coming up in just a second. But first, this news just came in. Right now, the government and private banks are liquidating houses. Now, these are homes that have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and they may be sold for little or no money down. Here's a toll-free number so you can find out how to get a free list of these foreclosures. 1-800-923-1051. 1-800-923-1051. It says here, every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes, and they may be sold for little or no money down. Looks like there's currently over 400,000 foreclosures in the database being liquidated now. Homes may be sold for little or no money down. Ask how you can get a free list of these foreclosures by calling Hot Props at 1-800-923-1051. Call 1-800-923-1051. That's 1-800-923-1051.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, these braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
These days, carrying a mortgage can overwhelm even the strongest person.
Don't I know that?
But there is a way to help ease your struggle, especially if you're facing foreclosure. One option may be advice from a certified foreclosure prevention specialist. It's absolutely free. Don't struggle. Learn more at www.makinghomeaffordable.gov. That's makinghomeaffordable.gov. Because foreclosure is not a foregone conclusion. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Monthly payment calculation assumes 5% down at 7% APR over 30 years.
You know what happens to a beautiful four-bedroom, two-story house when the owners default on their loan? Some private bank becomes the new owner. And when a mansion in the hills is confiscated due to unpaid taxes, the government takes possession. But the government, the private banks, they're not in the real estate business, so they want to unload these houses as fast as they can, sometimes selling them for substantially below market value. Imagine finding a great three-bedroom, two-bath home for $30,000. That's just $190 a month. To learn how to get a free list of foreclosures, call now, 1-800-351-0322. CRN is offering a home rebate of up to $1,000 in cash, and you can find out how to get up to an extra $2,500 on top of that. Call in the next 30 minutes to learn how to get a free list of foreclosures that may be in your area. 1-800-351-0322. 1-800-351-0322.
We'll just listen up, you all right?
More rock now. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.